Anyway, thank you very much. Members, I thought that maybe what we should do, we will be starting with the briefing because and we'll deal with the minutes later. Honorable Soma should be joining us shortly. She is delayed. Maybe we might have to take the briefing first. But before that, let me accept, or let's consider apologies. Honorable Hlongwa, Honorable Young Blood, and Honorable Boy, and Matubazana. They won't be with us this morning. Thank you very much, members. Are those apologies accepted?
Yes,
thank you. Honorable Kasim will also be joining us. I suggest that we go straight to the funding model of the National School of Government. Over to you, Prof. Levin.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, Minister, colleagues. thank you for this opportunity for us to present the work that we've done so far around the new funding model for the National School of Government. Okay, in this presentation, we will give a background which explains the current funding and business model of the NSG. We'll also look at the challenges which the school has faced in implementing the funding model. And we'll make proposals around the alternative we've come up with and get the views from the portfolio committee on the proposed revisions. The mandate of the NSG comes from the Public Service Act to provide training or facilitate the provision of training. And in doing so, it recovers costs for revenue generation to augment the training trading account. So the current funding model is basically dual in character. We get a voted fund allocation, which is appropriated by Parliament, and the other side is the income we derive from cost recovery through training course fees, which is managed through the training trading account. All costs we incur relating to the development of materials, curriculum, is funded through the recovery of costs through provision of training and facilitation of training across the public service. Now, we obviously are sensitive to the environment within which these revisions take place, which is one of austerity, budget cuts, which have been imposed on the NSG last year as we reported to the committee, and which did adversely affect the way in which we had to operate within the competitive environment required through a cost recovery model. We've also looked at some international cases and done a bit of benchmarking of funding models of schools of government, both middle-income countries, African countries, as well as some OECD member countries. Now, in the past, as an OECD report which was published in the late 1990s pointed out, public sector training institutions did not compete with the private sector, but at that period, in the late 1990s, many training institutions in different states across the globe were operating more like private enterprises and competing in an open market situation. Now, that was largely driven by what one might call the new public management, which influenced public service reform from the late 1980s through into the 1990s. So there was a shift away from strong government training institutions towards outsourced models. When the OECD did a survey 20 years later, it did identify the need for strong schools of government and the role they can play in applied workplace learning. If we look at the National School of Government and the comments made on it in the National Development Plan, the observation is that the NSG, in its evolution from Samdi to Palama, was set up to run short-term courses and is constrained by demand-led funding model and buying in training capacity. And the NDP requires that we begin to shift the way in which we work. In other words, we build in-house capacity, which we're doing by strengthening the training capacity inside the School of Government, but also through the utilization of public servants across the system on an eight-day basis in programs like induction, already operational, as onboard trainers. And at the same time, to redesign the funding model and the way in which the funds are allocated and generated within the NSG. So the truth of the matter is that the 1998 white paper on public service training and education set the tone, because it looked at centralized norms and standards, but decentralized provision by state and non-state providers in a competitive framework. So that kind of privatization or semi-privatization of public sector training was a policy position expressed in the white paper. And basically what this led to was the development of a multiplicity of education and training providers operating in a market environment. those were internal organizations like SAMDI at the time, and external providers, universities, universities of technology, NGOs, and also private training institutions. And that led to the Treasury, the Minister of Finance, establishing through Regulation 19 the trading account for the SAMDI, later Palama, and now the NSG. So the cost recovery has a lot of challenges in implementation, and we can't talk to them, but I think if we just look at the numbers, we begin to see where some of the problems lie. So if we look at the six-year cycle, from 2011-12 to 2016-17, if we look at the revenue generation in relation to the number of persons trained, for example, we see that the highest year of revenue generation so far was in 2012-13, and the person trained there was 30,500 approximately. In the next year, the revenue generated was 109 million. Sorry, these are millions, but in the number of people trained was 33,700. So it shows that there isn't a direct relationship between the number of people trained and the revenue generated, and that's because different courses have different pricings attached to them. And it's difficult in a free market environment to protect or determine which courses that will have the largest uptake in a particular cycle. We don't have the final verified and audited number of persons trained in 16-17, but it's likely to be 60,000 or exceed 60,000, and yet the revenue generation is lower than the 33,000 and the 30,500 in 2012-13. So the model is very unpredictable. And we obviously need to find ways of introducing predictability while still retaining the different forms in which the funding comes. So basically in the 2016-17 financial year, as we reported to the committee, the NSG vote was significantly reduced, and that's because of the budget cuts that happened at the beginning of 2016 and the decision by the Treasury to take the reserves of the NSG, which we then had to use as our to make good on the shortfall in the budget allocation. But in any event, the problem with the amounts we're dealing with is if we want to build an institution with the right kind of staff, the right kind of infrastructure, the only way we can succeed is through augmenting this through revenue generation. So I think there the challenge is investment in IT infrastructure. Our systems are not geared towards the mass training we've embarked on. There's a lot of manual processes in verifying attendance registers, and that's why we often undercount, because we're unable to count in time for the audits, the auditors to count all the people that we have actually trained. In a procurement process, we are competitive in terms of price because we have lower pricing compared with many service providers, but we are not the preferred training provider, which means that if departments want to use our services, they have to procure us like they would procure any other service provider. And that puts us in competition, including with the private sector, that may not bring relevance in terms of applied workplace learning, but they would have other inducements which would make their courses more attractive. That would include technology. They do provide, in certain cases, technology. They load all the materials onto a tablet, and that becomes part of the course fees. We can't compete with that. We've looked into even trying to do that. It's not possible. Another challenge we faced is obviously the one which the honorable members would be familiar with, and that's the 30-day payment stipulation, which is often not met, and in cases no payment at all, with the result that there's a potential bad debt of $17.5 million to write off in the current year. We did, following advice from Parliament mainly, then introduce a prepayment system. It works. We do have to grant deviations in certain cases, though. Now, the original tariff structure came in December 2007. It was submitted to National Treasury. It was provisionally approved, and it was based on a model of the NSG as a facilitator, not a provider of training. In other words, it built in the outsourced character of the training, which was evolving under Palama. We have now taken a review, an analysis of the current tariff structure, the number of persons trained, the escalating costs of direct and indirect costs due to inflation, and basically other increases have a direct influence on the daily cost. So we have come up with a new tariff structure. It looks at the different modes of training delivery, partnerships, and charges associated with the different modes of training delivery, which would include e-learning, because up until now we haven't had a clear tariff for our e-learning programs, and yet we increasingly do have the option of both open online training as well as e-learning with blended with face-to-face. So now we have a tariff structure which has different components. When we have partnerships with universities, NSG courses and workshops, e-learning courses, professional advisory and consulting, we do have a methodology of doing training needs analysis and skills audit, and we do have a demand for it, even if our capacity is relatively small. But we've been doing it free of charge, yet we're supposed to operate on a cost recovery basis. attendance at conference and seminars and international training. So that is the tariff structure which we have developed now. In looking at what are the options going forward to try and revise the model, we looked at different institutions, and we looked at African countries, Liberia, Rwanda, and Uganda. and the main challenge there was they did also have a mixed model, but recovering the cost has been a very big challenge in those countries. So Liberia receives partial funding. to cover some of the operating expenses, but only 50 to 65% of fees are actually paid. So they obviously have shortfalls. And Rwanda is only managing to generate 2% of their own revenue. And there appears to be no single model for funding allocation. There's a variety, and most of them are mixed and moving in different directions. But there are also... there is some information about some of the other countries we looked at, Mexico, Italy, Australia, New Zealand, and Brazil. What's interesting is the number of people trained. So in a sense, you know, we're training as many people and more than Brazil in the last few years, with a smaller population, but possibly a larger direct funding allocation if you look at the US dollar amount that they have received. In Australia, they have quite a small number of people they're training, but quite a relatively large US dollar funding allocation. And most of these would have a mixed model approach to the way in which they operate. But the fee for service has become a characteristic of state training institutions. and obviously, the issue of resources is fundamental. so there are countries with base funding. There are countries which rely more on the cost recovery. But then there's other countries which have reversed the trend. One example is actually Canada, which has moved to a capitation fee and moved away from cost recovery and is using online training for over 90% of its activities now. So what is the value proposition which we propose before coming onto the funding model? Firstly, we obviously have to look at the reality of the policy environment and the national development plan and the need to build a capable developmental state. If we are going to build the human capabilities which will allow a developmental state to operate, meeting people's needs as well as having a development orientation, as well as engendering participation in policy and implementation as required by the Constitution in Chapter 10, then we need to establish a national school of government which is a center of excellence for applied workplace skills development. And the revised funding model will need to fund curricula which are specific to the objectives of the NDP and the vision of a capable developmental state with a strong public service which meets the needs of the people. we need to be able to identify where the gaps are in human capabilities through a needs analysis and skills audit. We need to look at whether the training actually changes behavior. Are people changing the way they function in the workplace? Are they becoming better public servants, as it were, more effective and more efficient? Are they improving their institutional performance as a result of training? In other words, is there an impact? And we would seek to work more with DPME to look at the impact of the training interventions, possibly through their national evaluation program. And then is there value for money? So these are the issues which are driving the thinking about how to revise the funding model. Now, basically, in an environment where there can be no new money, how can we innovatively think about engendering more resources for the NSG while still remaining competitive as an institution? In other words, being able to deliver quality and empowering public servants to meet the needs of the people in South Africa. So if we look at the training budgets of national departments, in other words, what is allocated to national departments for human resource development? National government alone has projected training expenditure of 2.7 billion rand for this year. And they are using that to hire various providers, including the NSG and possibly other government entities. This is national government we're talking about, though. There are provincial governments which have training academies. And this amount does, however, include specific personnel. In other words, those with occupations in health, in defense, and in the police. So that sort of also means that if we're looking at diverting some of that budget to the National School of Government, we need to understand that there will be no one size fits all if we're going to apply some kind of cut to the national departments in order to generate a higher allocation to the NSG. We obviously focus on generic administration, management, and leadership for public servants, and we also seek to now prescribe a suite of courses through a ministerial directive, which would be phased in incrementally over a five-year period and take into account each and every department's needs or challenges. And over time, the NSG would also need to build capacity to assess the professional development of the entire public service. So in other words, where there are specific professional qualifications, be it in health, in engineering, or whatever, it doesn't imply that the National School of Government would provide for that, but the National School of Government would need to identify where the shortfalls are in that provision and make sure that the partnerships are in place between those departments which require the specialized skills and the professional training institutes, often universities, that will actually fulfill those. Now, if we want to look at our coverage, it currently includes provinces, but division of revenue would make it very difficult to try and divert provincial budgets to the National School of Government. But once compulsory courses are in place, provinces would require training in these, and we would need to continue servicing our relationships with provincial governments and local governments through a memorandum of understanding and agreement. So if we look at the 1% of the budget allocated to national departments, and if we say let's look at a 7.5% reduction in that budget, which would have to be differentiated according to departments. Departments with academies and sectoral colleges would obviously need to let go of less than departments that have no training institutions in place within their sector or environment. So if we do that 7.5% top slice, as it's often called, that's not really a technical term, but if we take a slice from the national training budget of 7.5%, it would amount to just over 100 million in this current financial year. We're not obviously proposing that it begin in this financial year, and we will give some indicative numbers of what this model would mean. But I think it's important that we would want the money to be allocated to the NSG and not held in lieu of provision of the actual training of the compulsory courses. So we would put together the mandatory programs, and departments will be allocated a set number of person training days to be trained at no cost. In other words, we would then go and provide the compulsory courses for free. It wouldn't mean that there would be no environment in which we would be competing, because in certain areas of the work that we do, we would be competing with other institutions and selling our courses because we believe they are the best and most appropriate for the public service. This is indicative. That's why we've put the watermark there. So if we say that we have a vote in 2017-18 of 95.9 million and we transfer 65 million of that to the trading account, if we take a top slice under this current year, which obviously is not going to happen, and then we able to generate revenue of 65 million, then we would have a budget of 328.9 million. So this is how we've modeled it, just to show the kind of impact on the NSG budget. So obviously, if we want to implement this, we need to look at all the role players. The National Treasury plays a crucial role in the implementation of such a model. So it would need to define the legal instrument for the top slicing. How would that slice take place? That's one part of it, the technical part that deals with the budget. We have undertaken several consultations with National Treasury, and there is support for this approach. So I will also indicate as we go along the kind of consultation to date around this. But what is also critical is for the NSG to consult with the DPME, the National Treasury, the DPSA, and the Public Service Commission, who would help us to identify the compulsory course requirements, which we would go into the ministerial directive. So the minister then would be in a position to issue a directive, and we would then need to identify dedicated capacity to focus on the delivery of these courses in national departments. Treasury has allocated us some additional funding to set up a specific sales unit within our marketing environment, and we are in the process of hiring contract staff to test a model of trying to increase our sales through these sales and marketing agents. We would also very importantly need to be recognized as a preferred service provider for public service training. So if I need legal advice, which I don't have capacity for in my own department, I can go to the state attorney's office and request legal services. I don't actually procure it. I can even ask them, the person who I think would be best placed to give advice to us, and they will help us get hold of that person. But there's no procurement process, and then we transfer the funds simply through that. So it's that kind of system that we're looking at. We have consulted with our peers and colleagues through the GNA cluster, but that process is still ongoing. The Forum of South African Directors General Management Committee has given approval for this kind of approach, but obviously we need to work through the detail. So different departments have very specific requirements. For example, higher education and training, within their human resource development budget, they are paying for lecturers in TVET colleges. So we obviously cannot take a slice of that money. We can only take a slice of the money they use for training their internal staff, their administrative and management staff. So there's a lot of detailed work that needs to be done, but within the public service, the key role players are certainly encouraging us to move forward with this kind of approach. It is, at the end of the day, a mixed model, but it is about increasing the allocation, but not just for anything, for specific compulsory courses that then we will provide at no cost to public service departments. So we do have some recommendation that we are requesting Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members and Minister, that the Portfolio Committee notes the background to the current funding model and its implementation challenges, notes engagements which we need to have with the critical departments, which also would include the Public Service Commission, to inform the Ministerial Director. The fact that we have been engaging with the National Treasury about this whole approach, which in a sense we have built in partnership with them, and notes that they will support us in designating through the Minister of Finance the NSG as a preferred provider for public service training, and that departments should be exempted from competitive procurement processes when acquiring services from the National School of Government. It wouldn't prevent them from acquiring other services for courses which aren't compulsory, but certainly if they would want to secure our services, it would be a straightforward transfer. And then, obviously, we look forward to getting ideas and any issues which the Portfolio Committee could put before us for consideration as we go through the process of finalizing this. So we've put time frames. We obviously do want to make sure that we can get this into the process so that in 2018-19 we would commence with the application of this model. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. There you are, members. We have only 27 minutes to deliberate on this matter. So I ask you, I would like to appeal to you, especially Honorable Nisom, not to take too long.
If she's going to speak.
Oh, okay. All right. There you are, members. Deputy Minister, welcome.
Salavat, you have your hand up?
Yeah.
Oh. And yes, you are. No. From which side? Who wants to ask questions? If you are very happy, can you raise your hands? Who wants to speak? Yes, Honorable Sandabat, Honorable Motav. Yes, Honorable Members. Council, yes. And Honorable Lusoma. In that order, please. Honorable Mantombela, you are not going to speak.
Mantombela.
No, I said Ndombe. No, but what's wrong with that? I'm revolutionizing your surname.
Ochi, I think it's good, as the presenter said, is that we should note, because obviously the negotiations and dealings with the other three or four departments must happen, and then we'll come back to this committee for deliberation on it and see what they offer. They might come with complete different proposals. But what I am interested in a lot of correspondence one receives, is that there is the feeling or the perception that there is no formal structure or a legal structure of the National School of Governance. And if I can be clarified on whether it indeed was approved, a ministerial approval of the current structure, if not, why not? And when will it happen? And, you know, the concerns by the bargaining council, of course they have issues with it as well. So if we can get clarity on that, because I think that could also lead to not so positive working relationships of various staff members. There are a lot of issues on this, but we'll put written questions for sure.
Good question, Honourable Honourable.
Thank you, Chair. I was going to raise that issue, but it's been raised now, so I just go to something even before we get to this new funding model. The note that the school has a bad debt of 17 million rand. How does this happen? Because, you see, it doesn't matter what we do now, even if we're going to a new funding model and stuff like that, if we do not keep our books and make sure that people to whom we have given service pay up, it's not going to help. If you can just clarify me on this thing, because it's a very, very important thing. It either says that the school doesn't have the capacity to be able to get people to pay them, or they are not billing the people, or whatever it is. So please check on that for us, please.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I've got just 2 points to raise. If you can just clarify if the school in itself is making any impact on in terms of training to institutions. Because if you look at the note that you made, like Honorable Mutaung has said, that you've got a sort of a shortfall of that amount. One would ask a question if you are really making any sort of a positive impact on your mandate. you spoke about on your presentations that there were different models throughout the country that you have identified or that you have spotted. Can you maybe just elaborate on that? And also, you pointed out Treasury has not released or decided not to give you an additional funding. Is that because you are not making any, you know, significant impact, or was there any specific reasons attached to that? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mkandela.
Thank you very much, Chair. I appreciate the report. Chairperson, the National School of Government concept has a ministerial support, like Professor has indicated. But still, there's still these problems that are ensuing. I do not understand where lies the problem exactly. Is it the administrative will to implement, or is it the political will? Because this has the support that that it deserves. So where actually is the problem of given all the problems that Professor has indicated? And the model that the National School of Government is proposing is hybrid. It's a mixed kind of a thing. And there is an intention to recover, but it's partial. It's a partial recovery model. Why not the total recovery, given the challenges that we have in the public service and what we want to achieve in the public service? Why still have we to still go for a partial kind of a thing? Because there is a ministerial support. That's what we need. But you have just indicated that there would be services that would be given free of charge. But I still do not understand the motivation behind that. And maybe have you ever considered the gradual kind of a process? Maybe you start with compulsory, the total recovery, then given the problems that you always encounter, you go partially, gradually, and so on and so on. But you start with a full house, so to speak. Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Lisson.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and I would like to welcome myself to this meeting. Chair, it's just 2 points. For me, it's not more of questions, it's more of a recommendation moving forward. And I'm sure the Minister also will ask us in this one, that can we not, I'm saying that very mindful that some of the activities in the remodernization of the funding of the NSG is not within the control of the NSG and the ministry is responsible for. To have a roadmap that will give us the time frame so that as we monitor it on our tracking system, as it were, we are able then get to have a necessary interventions where it's necessary when issues need to be elevated at this level of the portfolio committee. That's one, Chair. Two, Chair. If they can, I know this one is the portfolio committee, we have been raising it, but as one of our oversight role that I would like us to play is the causes that are provided by NSG must talk also in mitigating the issues raised by or observed by the impact results, as it were, and prioritizing certain departments in ensuring that there is a sort of inverted commas compulsory training interventions that are done to make sure that departments do deliver on what they are expected to do, mostly which are largely, even the last year's one, it's more of a compliance issue so that we can understand what is the rationale of them failing on those aspects. The last one, Chair, which is a sub of the second point, it's School of Governance also to be progress, to be aggressive, moving with us as the portfolio committee, thinking a wish, so to speak, that the IT system must also be geared also to provide those training, so that you don't necessarily take your inverted commas learners or students to outside the working environment, so that at least there is that communication and using that system, but it has to be upscaled so that it can respond to the point that I'm raising, Chair. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Just to add in this question, so that when you respond, you can respond to all of us. You know, Prof, you said you are operating in a free market environment. And now, once you start with that statement, one would then be tempted to ask you, what is your competitive edge, other than the fact that, apart from being a school of government that is established by government, you have all these legislative instruments that are establishing you. What is it that would make any public servant, you know, feel they are missing out if they are not coming to you? And I'm saying this, and I think Honorable Lusom, I'm not sure if Honorable Minister, you did attend our own program that we started when I was in local government. We trained a lot of people, and we didn't have any budget at all. And we're training from where we started. I started off when I was CEO of Kwanaloka. We trained even municipality from all over the country, including some government departments. They came to us. We were running an executive leadership program. It was very, very popular. Now, that speaks to one's competitive edge, because sometimes we take a back seat and think, wow, anyway, we are established by government, so government, please support us. We are with you. Why not? You know, it doesn't work like that. So I wanted to ask you that. And secondly, I was saying, in these 2.7 billion that's there, what is your share? The share of the school, of that money. And if you could elaborate as well why that share is where it is, because obviously it's very, very low. If you are going to approach it from the percentage point. The other thing that to me is going to be very important, I think I'm getting into a very difficult space, but I think it's got to be asked. It's the learning methodology that you use, because I have found that students usually enjoy like syndications, you know, where they syndicate on a particular case study methodology. It's practical, going on the field. The course that we ran on waste management strategies, the reason why many people were coming to us and they would not go to anybody else, it's because we're not just training people, you know, it was not just a tick-the-box kind of thing. It was not theory. It was very practical. And a lot of municipalities began to realize that, hey, we need to invest more money in waste management, because you will take them on site and they will begin to understand how do you dispose different kinds of waste, because you don't dispose them the same similar way. Now, I'm asking you that question because everybody, they always identify their own niche. And yes, we are supporting you, but we want it to be compatible that when we are supporting you, we are supporting a school that is geared towards innovation, that is understanding that, you know, it's not just a given that you are going to be having people flocking into the school or whatever. The other thing that I think was asked by Honorable Kwandefat is the issue around the structure. Is the school structure approved now? Is it there? What's going on? Because as long as we have not finalized that, it's going to be a bit of a problem. And the other question I wanted to know is whether you have considered integrating some programs that you have with universities, especially because one of the things I think is a problem with South African universities, I don't know if you guys have observed this, but I've come across a lot of graduates that are coming out of the university, but honestly, I can't give them any job. They're coming in, the only thing they have is a degree. They can write an essay, a very good essay. They can reference, they can do all that, but it doesn't go beyond that. Now, what are we doing to ensure that the university output informed by us as NSG are beginning to give us the results that we desire? Because sometimes, even when we are asking for this money, we should be looking for this money sometimes, not necessarily that we're going to be running it ourselves, but maybe because we are going to be channeling the money to the right places where we know that these people are really good at that. And do we have a database of different training providers in the country and their different strengths in terms of because I'm looking more at the capacity of the school, because one of the things we must not make a mistake of is to think that the school is going to be everything and everything. They are, like, for example, if you are talking, I know that you've excluded the sectoral things, so I'm saying I understand that, but you know, there are specific things like health and safety standards, how to apply them and whatnot. Some of those are, you have well-established institutions that are very good with those aspects, but the school could leverage on them and advance forward. And finally, I just wanted to know, you know, one thing that I thought I have to say to you, Prof, is that I am very happy with the school, and I really, really would like to see the school prospering. And as a result, I want to know whether is there any kind of alignment with the provincial schools? Are we aligning all these training programs? Like, for example, maybe if we think, and by alignment, I'm not just talking about signing an MOU or whatever. I'm talking about maybe, say, as the school, if you are, you could look at, say, maybe KZN or maybe Limpopo is very good at this. When that program is run, it's going to be run in Limpopo. Because there are other things that you can't take away, and I know that many people were coming to our training because we were in Durban. That's true. I mean, I had a lot of people that came to our training. I could see that this one is not coming for training. You know, they just missed the sea. So I'm saying, have you actually thought about those things? Because there are so many things that we need to be thinking about that excite students, that appetize them to, you know, that make them to want to be associated with the school. And again, do you have, like, when you have your graduations, what do you do? How do you do your own graduations? Do you have something where you provide some of your best students? I remember we had, you remember Dudu, we had Dudu, she was very good with performance management. She was one of the students there from Johannesburg. Dudu Maseko. You know, we had to do, like, the profiling of her as our graduate because she was very good and she started doing more training to others. And, even people, we're using even some of the people that were well-known in the field, like Krishnaid, when it came to municipal finance, you couldn't afford, everybody wanted to come to that class because they knew there was somebody that is a brand when it comes to that specialized field, you know. So I know I'm asking you too many questions, but maybe you can try and do that. Just know that, Mina, I support you, and I do honestly feel members that we will definitely have to meet with National Treasury, and I still feel strongly that we need to meet with DPME, Because DPME, I honestly don't think that they are doing what they are supposed to be doing. When it comes to the prioritization, the budget cuts and whatnot, I actually want that as a specific resolution once the prof has answered these questions, that we need a specific resolution around DPME. Because unless DPME up there again, we are going to end up with these problems. We can't expect National Treasury to decide on the priorities of government. National Treasury is there primarily for the fiscal policy and to balance the books of government. They are not there to start thinking about, you know, that is why they will not prioritize prof if prof is saying, I need more money. They're going to say, why do you need more money? You know? And why do people need to be trained? When we advertise posts, we advertise posts and we say people must have this and these competencies. Why do we need more training? And they may just cut without really understanding the implications. Over to you, Prof.
Thank you very much for the questions. ngizoqala ngicela ukuthi nisithuthise nisiyisele eThekwini sifuna ukusebenza khona. But I think I would actually like to start with your first and your final issues. I just want you to connect some dots there in the questions and issues you've raised. Because you do say, how do we compare ourselves with other universities? You're also asking about the quality of public administration and schools of government within the university environment. And you're asking also for the competitive edge which we have in what one might term a free market environment. I think the critical thing is what we say in the value proposition, because we are in the value proposition trying to propose that the competitive edge is around workplace learning, applied learning in the workplace. It's very easy to get a professor from Wits, Pretoria University, Northwest, Limpopo, to stand up in front of a class and say, this is what the PFMA says. But how do you take a rule and translate it into implementation without having all these delays and blockages? That's a completely different kind of skill. And those are the skills that we need to build. And that's the competitive edge. We have highly qualified people in the senior management service. They work in departments, they work in the National Treasury, they work in the National School of Government. They have to implement legislation. They have to implement regulations. That's what we need to know in the public service. That's where a lot of the blockages are. We talk about 30-day payment. That's a very basic thing, but there are a lot of blockages in 30-day payments. You all know that. I don't need to convince anyone here. And those are technical issues which the professor from Pretoria will not be adept at finding a solution to. But public service trainers within the public service know how to do it practically, and they are qualified. They have degrees. They have masters. Many of them in the SMS have master's degrees. The whole issue is the application of knowledge, and that's where we have to excel. So in this country, we need to build institutions. I moved into this institution. Okay, I'm a rare breed, if I may give my personal experience. Not globally, Botswana, we don't even have to go very far. Uganda, Kenya, Canada. We have people at the top layer who serve in different departments and who are moved from department to department. So I've been a DG for many years, and I did move into a department which has developed so many visions, from Sandy to Palama to the NSG, none of which have actually been realized. We do need to stabilize the administration. It's a fundamental part of Chapter 13 of the NDP. I don't agree with everything in the NDP Chapter 13, but I certainly read it very closely, regularly. I read what it says there because there's a lot of relevance. We need to build institutions. Now, when you move into an institution and there is a determination by a minister in 2013 that this is the interim structure of the NSG, that is where you have to work. That's where you have to start your work. So there is a submission for approval of that very structure, actually, the way in which we have been operating, for formal approval. We have clean audits for many, many years. The corporate governance is not the problem. The application of prescripts may be a problem. So one has to build the institution and fix the back office. That is the process around the structure. I'm sure together with the executive authority we will finalize that. That captures the structure as is, because the urgency was to make this institution work. On the performance side, from the moment I came to the portfolio committee, the embracing attitude of the chairperson was not there because we never met the targets. Okay, so now we've got to a position where we are starting to meet the targets. And that was the focus. That's what we really need to do. We don't need to come and say we'll train all these people and then we're unable to train them. So we need to actually fix the performance of the institution. And certainly there are challenges which I've encountered in terms of the application of prescripts, but nothing that has ever led to a clean audit. So you once asked us the last time, what is the use of a clean audit if the organization is not performing? Mm-hmm. Well, we're moving to a situation where we have a clean audit, the organization is performing. But I don't believe that employees' rights are being trodden upon in any way in the NSG right now, and that we will have those approvals in place. It will not change much, but it will allow us then to, with a new funding model, begin to look at where the competitive edge is and how we shift, as the NDP has asked us to, and as we are. 2 years ago, training was being outsourced. There were things in the pipeline which I've really tried to pull together in order to say, let's use the capacity of this school. We now have a lead facilitator development program, an outstanding program. What is the methodology? I'm proposing to Parliament that we present 3 courses in this Parliament before the end of the year. The first one is an ethics online program.
So we are becoming a target now.
Well, online. We can learn from parliamentarians on how to... We have an online blended ethics program we are proposing that parliamentarians could go into. We would set up a lab. Those that are coming in on a two-day interactive with the computer and a one-day interactive face-to-face in group discussions, the way we try and facilitate, as well as a woman in leadership in partnership with Stanford University and the American University in Washington, because you want to see excellence. And we believe the program we've developed is an excellent program. So we want to do one on women leadership and then a generic leadership program. Well, I'm also saying this because that would be the opportunity for parliamentarians to see for themselves rather than for me to simply preach that these are the things we're doing. But I believe we have quality. Our accredited programs, the short learning management courses, are all done in collaboration with the DPME, the National Treasury, DPSA.
We have 4 women in this committee right now, out of 6 members.
Including the DM and the minister.
Yeah, you're talking about members.
Yeah, so in any event, I do think some of the methodology we're using in the lead facilitator development program, for example, there's a big focus on training within the African continental environment, training within the context of the kind of developmental challenges of social inequality, unemployment, etc. So, and poverty. So we are trying to ensure that we use some of the most advanced methodologies which involve interaction. In other words, we don't go for an industrial model. An industrial model, even online, is people just sit there with computers in front of them and someone stands in front of the class and preaches for 2 hours and walks away. That's how sometimes even technology-mediated learning is done. So we are really looking at pedagogies of empowerment to really get people to interact. Some of the professors from Stanford are really, really strong in terms of eliciting participation. By the way, a number of parliamentary back office staff participated in the Stanford program recently in Cape Town, and we got very, very good feedback from that staff. So I think that's another way in which, I'm just saying that, you know, we can definitely look at the issues that you've raised and say that we are moving in that direction as firmly and as speedily as we are able to. So the whole issue of impact is something that, you know, I've indicated perhaps we can get an opportunity to look at the application of learning studies that we do, where we try and track employees and what happens to them when they go back to the workplaces. That is outcomes. It's not really impact-based, but we recognize that we need to do impact-based study. We would like to choose a sector, possibly health, where we would need to work over a two-year period, look at the training interventions, look at the impact it has on staff performance. It's the only way one can do those things, and I don't think there's that many initiatives. So we are sort of trying to pioneer and spearhead an initiative in that regard. And I would emphasize that, you know, on the performance side, the way in which we're moving is very positive. But to really build the institution, like many institutions, takes a period of time, and we need to get that model right. And the mixed model, the hybrid as you call it, perhaps gives us an opportunity, because the issue is that most of the countries, you know, in terms of the hybridity, there is an element of base funding, and that's what differs from country to country. And then there is an element of co-payment or cost recovery. I think that it won't do us any harm to continue in a competitive framework, because I look at the staff and managers of this institution, and the questions which are raised are not necessarily my ideology in the way I'm responding, but I do think that having to compete does bring a sharpness in the organization and a responsiveness in the organization which would disappear if we simply were fully funded. So it's not necessarily my ideology, but I'm recognizing the reality of where we are and how we also need to incentivize our own people to express their excellence and develop their excellence. So I think building the institution and its people is certainly what we're very, very much focused on. And we're not asking for a lot, because, you know, what is it that the 2.7%, if we look at the voted funds and own revenue in the previous year, 5%. 5% is what we got, both through our own effort as well as through what was allocated. If we want to look at the allocation, it's like 1%, you know, the voted funds. But if we look at the revenue that we generated, it was an exceptional year because of the way in which we were cut, but that's just the reality. So we're not necessarily moaning and whining that we can't do anything. We're trying to get on with the job as best we can with the resources we have at our disposal, with the institutional limitations and strengths, and to build the institution in a way in which, you know, we would be able to, you know, be an example of excellence within the public sector. So I think on the side of the National Treasury, it's also fair to say that they gave us additional funding where they gave no other departments in this year to set up the sales unit, to make the model work. And, you know, we found what it is, and the kind of money they gave us may not be adequate, but it will help, because we do need soldiers out there who are making sure that there's an uptake. And that's the approach we're going to have to take with the kind of funding we got. We won't be able to, hire sort of high-level key account managers, which is what sales is about, people who will understand the business better than DGs and HODs and go and sell the programs to them. We will not be able to do that for the funding, but we will be able to have foot soldiers who can take forward the message of the NSG and the advantages of the programs of the NSG, and we will certainly do that. So administrative or political will, there is will all around. That's been my experience. Treasury is not blocking us. They're helping us. They're supporting us. The DGs are not blocking us. They're supporting us. They're even telling us to be more bold. Many of you on the political level are also saying, be more bold. Why are you just looking for that small percentage? Why don't you go for something more ambitious? But we want to look at what we can do, what we can absorb. Treasury looks at everything in ratios. Now suddenly your budgeting increases exponentially by more than 50%. Can you utilize that funding? Well, the model, mixed delivery model which we have, will allow us to, because we do have a pool. We have a program called Ruta Nangma Afrika. We are attracting people from across the public service, retired public service servants, even retired parliamentarians have expressed an interest to come and be part of our teaching staff to present courses. So I'm sure if we develop the partnership with Parliament, there will also be retired parliamentarians who will be part of the teaching faculty. So I think the time frame issue raised by Honourable Lisima, I think what we will do is we'll just do a short of the final slide. We did make some additions because we anticipated following discussions which we had with our minister and deputy minister that we should put in some time frame. So we've done that on the final slide on the screen. And we will put it into a little grid and submit it to the committee after this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, are you happy about your questions were asked? You're happy.
What happened to the
670
million?
Oh, sorry, the bad debt. The bad debt. Sorry, sorry.
You're going to give you money and you're going to write it off again.
Look, we in the meeting we had with Treasury before we came here, they also said that because they did assist us, we went on our own first. I wrote to all the debting departments, the indebted departments, and then we did another letter. So perhaps you could indicate the amounts we because we did kind of do a focus on this thing. I'm not sure it's our capability, and it's part of the things that we need to fix in the public service. But we certainly put a big focus on it. Perhaps you could give the amount that we were able to, through that process, get back.
Thank you. Thank you, Tishin. We were able, through the help of National Treasury, to recover almost about 7 million. That was also the money reduced to 17 million now. But they've committed to help us again, to issue a letter again to the department, because it's an old debt. But what we have been put in place since 2015 is that we're now asking for prepayments for training. So we will not have this problem in the future. So it's historical ones that are going back to prior to about 2013, this debt that we're trying to recover now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Remember, I think what we will do, I feel too strongly that we need to meet to have an engagement with CPME
so that we can, because it's not just this matter. Remember, we have Statistics South Africa as well. And we need to start engaging with the PME. And you remember that Statistics South Africa, they've cut down their budget by 12%. And they are losing staff like crazy right now. We need to look at those issues so that they become part of informing budget cuts, because we can't stop that. We would be unrealistic if we say so. That's why we must be grateful, Prof, that you got something. But, of course, it's inadequate. But the kind of environment, the economic environment that we're going through, it's going to be very difficult for National Treasury to manage a good fiscal position of this country unless they do something about it. They've got to take somewhere. But when they take, we need to make sure that they don't take in those programs where we really feel strongly that if you take from there, you are going to compromise the entire public service. We need to, they need to be there to play that balancing act. And if with your agreement, members, I think that should be like the kind of resolution as well around this matter. Because we also feel strongly, from what I'm hearing from you members, I'm also thinking that we are saying, in as much as we agree that the school can't just wake up today and then they want the whole 2.7 billion to them, but we are saying National Treasury should consider probably making small cuts in those departments for that you can beef up the school. We are not saying National Treasury go and find new money. We're talking about the money that is there. Even if they have to go and find, maybe even if it's 1% or whatever that is that they can find from those departments. Because the thing is, I'm very concerned, and the reason why I was asking you, Prof, about the free market environment, sometimes I get very concerned that we are a developmental state, but sometimes we want to come with policies that would be well and good in developed countries, and we are still building. It takes a long time to build, you know, the institutional arrangements, to build the systems, to build all these things. And 23 years down the line is not a long time. Because remember, the first few years of our democracy, we're really busy trying to put the legislative, you know, the new legislative regime, and now we are beginning to actually apply. And that's when now we need the school. So maybe we need to, you know, get, when we engage with National Treasury together with the PME, these are some of the issues that we need to bring to them to say, listen, if we want to build a developmental state and we want to build a public service that is capable and so forth, you are not going to achieve that if you take all your money and you are giving to some people to make profits, huge profits out there. You need to have to apply your mind in terms of where do you channel your resources. You have very limited resources. Channel them properly so that you can achieve your desired outcomes and impact. So I think that should be our resolution, because we definitely want to see the school advancing and growing. And again, I must say, members, I attended something very important that Prophet organized, and I was very excited about that Africa program. And because I honestly feel that sometimes in South Africa we think we have this exceptionalism attitude that we are better than the rest of the continent. And we forget that the problems of the continent are our problems. And we have to take we need to play a role, a very significant role, in ensuring that, you know, we forge partnerships with our fellow African countries and develop capacity where we can. You know, and that's how we are going to ensure that eventually we need to decolonize ourselves. You know, this colonial scramble of Africa, whatnot, we need to find a way of dismantling all these colonial borders at some point. And I think if we start doing the training and we start doing and making sure that we train leaders there, eventually we will succeed as a continent. So I'm saying I have a vested interest here, and I must disclose, members, I have a vested interest. I'm very passionate about the route that the school is taking when it comes to Africa, and it has my support, Minister, my personal support. So I
1.3 million
people in the public. Yeah, no, but realistically speaking, we only about 56, 58 million in South Africa. We probably have grown to a point of saturation in terms of growing. The only way we can grow as South Africa is if we start looking, we start promoting intra-Africa trade. That's the bottom line. And we're not going to promote intra-Africa trade if we have this exceptionalism attitude. And I think that is why I think as this committee, we need to, you must record that in the minutes, that we are supporting the school.
Yeah, we must ask the future
about, you want to object?
Sounding.
No, I know that Honorable Lusama will never ever object to me when I say something so progressive. Yes, over to you, Honorable Lusama.
Chair, I think it would be unfair if it becomes your personal, and then we keep quiet, because I thought from where I'm sitting now is the sentiment that all of us we share in this committee, yeah. Because even the financial model, the new financial model, we support it because there's a need, but also South Africa has to perform so that it can influence other African states to do that. That's one. So I'm saying, Chair, formally then, from Odia summary, that one will I agree and I support that there's a need with DPME, and I'm sure also Honorable Mthambi will also assist in that aspect, because it cannot be a, if we say new DPME, we mean even the new DG and the minister responsible, because these are not youth matters, it's more of issues that are one that is an appeal, which means I'm putting a rider on that, so that yes, also yeah. is a dual attempt, so to speak. Two, Chair, is the issue that we still need to, in that meeting, also invite Treasury also, so that they can understand that we are not necessarily dealing with the allocation of budgets, yes, of funds, yes, allocation of funds. We are dealing with a core, so that also they can understand the rationale. But both departments must understand their role in yes. terms of government performance, as it were. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much, members. I thought I should share with you that, okay, over to you, Minister, Deputy Minister.
Chair, I appreciate the approach you are taking, but I'm just thinking of adding another angle
okay.
to the suggestion of trying to strengthen the funding model itself, that as you engage with the Treasury and the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation, perhaps we can look into the issues of the CITAS as well, because there's a lot of money which are sitting in the CITAS, and they are doing with skills training the CITAS themselves. So I was trying to say, you know, we shouldn't look into the vote as she says. We must try to look around. But the other issue which I really wanted to raise is each time I think of the school, I get so excited and depressed at the same time, because this is one institution which can produce high quality public servants. And we need, maybe as all of us South Africans, including the committee itself, maybe we need to assist in this regard, to say how do we position the school itself to perform as is expected, to produce that type of public service we want. You know, the approach of this portfolio committee, I like it so much, because I always say to people, it is not about oversight, but you must also bring some ideas constructively, so to assist the department. So the issue of the CITAS, I would really appreciate if you can throw it in, even from ourselves with the minister, we'll try to do that, so that we help to develop the school itself. And I must also declare my passion.
Yeah. No, I'm glad. I think all of us, we are very passionate, and I love that. And honestly, that 1%, I'm always saying,
the problem is that sometimes we confuse this 1% that gets appropriated to CITAS. It's actually workers' money. It's actually workers' money, that one. It's the money of public servants. And we can't just let somebody somewhere, they just decide, you know how they're going to be spending this money. This CITAS must be functioning now, and we need to see that money working. But thank you very much, Honorable Lesama. I think we all, that is the committee position, Prof. I also wanted to say, members, I'm just taking this opportunity to say to you, I understand that there is a new DG in DPME, Mpumi Mbofu. And having worked with her in other capacities, I do know that she's very, very action-oriented, and I think we might be able to achieve what we wanted to get from that DPME, because it's been a bit of a challenge. It's been a serious challenge. I'm glad that they had to get her. So I'm saying we not... Oh, Minister, you want to say something?
No, I think that is the issue that Honourable Samantha raised, the issue of the structure.
Oh, the structure, yeah?
It's a matter that is at our table now, once we finalize the
tomorrow.
I said to her tomorrow, we will be able to send you the copy of the structure that we're going to approve. The other issue is in line with the government itself does not prefer to use the NSG, but we recall Section 4 of the Public Service Act established as a national department. I think that's the issue that we are seized with, to say we need to force these government departments to realize that, linking with your competitive edge. Normally we say you are seated with the issues wherein the AG is raising a lot of issues, department not complying, just to design that program that doing that and utilize the people that have done well. So these are some of the things that we are filled with, to see on the support of the NSG. They know that ourselves is the NSG. They have our undivided support on this matter. So we are mindful of the fact that this is the National Training Department of Government.
Yes. Thank you very much, Minister. We really appreciate that. Members, let's move on. Let's get a briefing from Mr. M. Kipofa on the Public Service and Administration on the implementation of the revised determination on other remunerative work to prohibit public servants from doing business with the state.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, Honorable Minister and Deputy Minister, colleagues. The presentation we'll be doing will focus on yet another building block that we are putting in place to strengthen professionalism in the public service. The Public Service Act has made provision for public servants who would want to do work that they get paid for outside their jobs, to follow certain processes to obtain approval. What we have done, although this provision has existed for some time now, we have strengthened that provision further to make sure that there are clear guidelines that the executive authorities can follow. So we'll talk about those in the presentation. We'll talk about the progress that we have made in the application of those provisions. And we'll also talk about its link to our attempt to prohibit public servants from doing business with the state. With your permission, Chairperson, my colleague Itumele Mungale will go into the details of the presentation.
No problem. Over to you, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to all honourable members, honourable minister and deputy minister, and all colleagues. In the presentation, I'll give a quick background about this directive, and then I'll go to the measures that we have put in place to implement the directive and the status as at 30 April 2017. And then I will turn the attention to a new directive that we issued in January that is specifically dealing with doing business with Oregon State. And then I'll provide the status in respect of that directive. Now, as a way of background, on 1 August 2016, the Minister for Public Service and Administration issued the Public Service Regulation 2016. And the reason why I'm specifically mentioning this, for the first time, we consolidated all ethics and anti-corruption measures into a single chapter that became an integral part of these regulations. And the regulations, specifically Regulation 13C, looks at prohibiting employees from conducting business with an organ of state, and it confers the power to the Minister for Public Service and Administration to determine the form and process for application for remunerative work, which is Regulation 24. Now, on the 1st of November 2016, the Minister issued the directive on other remunerative work, and the directive specifically prescribes the application form that all employees who seek to undertake remunerative work would use to request that permission. And the directive also prescribed the application process that must be followed within the 30-day period that is prescribed in terms of the Public Service Act, Section 30. And it also prescribed the certificate for approval. In the past, the department would, the executive authorities who has the power to grant permission would either write in a letter to say that approval is granted or is declined. But in terms of the new directive, there is a prescribed certificate that must be issued by the executive authority when approval is granted. And the directive also places a reporting obligation to all heads of departments to report non-compliance and all corrective measures to the DPSA by 30 April of each year. And finally, the directive also prescribes a compulsory capturing of application on PESAL system, and that is quite important and necessary, and later I'm going to speak more about that. The directive also prevents employees from using approved remunerative work to undertake business of an organ of state. And here I'm saying if the executive authority decides that I'm going to grant approval, the directive prevents that such employee to be able to come back and do business with the state simply because they got approval, so they cannot be able to do that anymore. So what have we done up to so far? As early as October last year, just before we issued the directive, we started to prepare the PESAL system, and we created a new function so that once the directive come into effect, departments will be able to then capture all new applications for remunerative of work on PESAL. And we created the different categories of remunerative of work, so we are able to know what kind of work has been granted for the different employees, because we have those different categories. And we, together with CETA, we started to conduct training to ethics officers and human resource officials in government departments to be able to use PESAL system to capture all the applications. And both the DPSA and National Treasury, we continue to monitor all registration on central supply database, and we screen that information against PESAL information to be able to see who is on the central supply database. Do we have government employees on the database? And if we detect government employees, we flag them on the central supply database. And those who are flagged, If they want to register, they will have to provide proof that they are not employees or that they have resigned as employees in government before they can be allowed to register on the central supplier database. What have we observed up to this stage? By 30 April 2017, we saw that departments have started to use the PESAL function to capture applications. But what I need to state, what we had built in the directive was that from the period 1 November to 30 April, all existing approvals and even deemed approval would be terminated. So departments and employees were given a period of 6 months to terminate all existing approvals, and those that were deemed approved. And that is why the status that I'm going to provide now is at 30 April, because that's when the termination came to an end. And what we have seen up to so far is that 20 national departments are using PESAL system to capture new applications, and we have 17 provincial departments, mainly from 6 provinces, that are using PESAL system to capture new application. And up to so far, 979 applications were captured. And of those 979, 433 are from national departments and 546 are from provincial departments. And this is the specifics now, 550 are approved, 59 deemed approved, 13 not approved, and 377 are still in the processing. And what kind of categories of remunerative work are prominent? Most employees seek to undertake remunerative work to do sales and marketing. So basically they're selling those cosmetics, they're selling small things, Tupperware, and about 80% they're doing some consultancy work, and about 7% is training, research and development. Those would be examiners at universities, lecturers, facilitators. Now, subsequent to the issuance of the directive on remunerative work, we also issued a directive in January 2017 on conducting business with organ of state, which then clarifies there was a lot of confusion about what constitute state. So the directive gives clarity on the definition of an organ of state, and it excludes certain activities that should not be considered as doing business with an organ of state. And an example is lecturing and examination, markings. And in collaboration with National Treasury, we then identified employees who are currently registered on Central Supplier Database and those who are conducting business with an organ of state. And this is what we found out. 11,516 were a number of employees registered on Central Supplier Database, and 893 are those who currently have contracts with organ of states, and 2,536 are those employees who are registered on Central Database but resigned from the public service by end of February 2017. What we did then, with all this information that we have at our disposal, we started to sensitize the executive authorities of all those employees who are the Central Supply Database, whether they're doing business or they're just registered there. But we needed to sensitize the executive authorities to make them aware of the situation. And in February 2017, the DPSA wrote to all heads of departments to report on those employees. And we were looking for information like whether they have terminated their employment in the public service or whether they still continue to do business with the state. And currently we are consolidating a report on the feedback received from departments. We have received information from a total of about 17 departments, with quite a number of employees who were on the database and those who were doing business with the state. And we will at a later stage be able to provide a complete feedback on what has happened with regards to this. In conclusion, Chairperson, like I've indicated, we're consolidating this information, but we'll continue to remind the department that it is compulsory to capture new applications on PESOL for remunerative work, and we will continue to provide training to departments to be able to capture this information. And to support these measures, we issued the draft regulations under Public Administration Act, specifically on prohibition of special advisors from conducting business with the state, because this was not covered by the Public Service Regulations of 2016. And we have made requirements for designated employees to disclose, and new categories of designated employees to disclose financial interests of spouses, and those who are in supply chain management, finance, and all deputy directors in government departments. And finally, we have criminalized the conducting of business of the state by conducting of business of the state by employees. Okay. Thank you very much, Chairperson, for affording us this opportunity to make this presentation.
Thank you very much, sir. There you are, member. Could you kindly indicate if you want to speak by raising your hand? Honorable Ntombela, Honorable Matao, Honorable Sandepas. Honorable Kao, are you going to speak? No? You're happy with the people doing business with the state?
How?
I knew you were going to make that comment.
Okay, over to you, Honorable.
Thank you, Chair. Step on the presentation that they're mailing.
I would like to understand the rationale behind the 6 months window period. But why the 6 months window period? Why not a year? Why not 3 months? Why not 1 month? Because the deal is done. It's not supposed to be done. But you have come out with a 6 month window period. I would like to understand the rationale behind that. At times you get special advisors to government who in turn make business with the same government. What happens in that particular regard? I'm reminded of Lindy from Treasure here. Okay, but it's business for another day. You also made mention of the training that is done by universities and consultants, 7%. Yeah, you mentioned that. I would like to check with you whether are you using the School of Government in that particular? Why are you using universities and other consultants? We've just been talking about that. What inhibits you from using the National School of Government instead of VETS University or independent tutors in that particular regard? Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Honorable Mata.
Thank you, Chair. Just a couple of quick things. Those employees who are being flagged, been detected and they're being flagged, I just saw something from the Scopa reports that the guys have become so smart now that they even use hobos to, you know, as people who are running their businesses. Do you guys have a way in which you're going to be able to follow up if Motawa has put up a front and somebody else who is doing that kind of thing? Because that is very important. Remember, every criminal is smarter than the guy who's trying to catch him. The other question, 20 national departments using personal system to capture da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and that's good. What about the rest? What are they doing? Are they not capturing and are they not doing it? Because I'm sure we have in more than 20 national departments in this country. And consultancy work at 8%, consultancy work, every time somebody say consultant, there's a red flag that goes up in my head. What kind of consultancy are we talking about? Because that's where the actual problem comes in, where people subvert and do other things like that. I think that should do for now. Thank you very much.
Another one. Mm.
You know, Chair, this is a topic that the Honourable Deputy Minister might recall. I started driving in the Limpopo Legislature many months ago. And this is the thing of staff and politicians, but in this case staff, doing business with government. And you know, we sat here, I think the last or second last meeting, when National Treasury announced in May that an investigation proved that about 12,000 debt people are registered to companies doing business with government in South Africa. And to make it even worse, another 14,000 are still listed as directors of companies doing business with the state. Now, years ago, we had something like a blacklist, wasn't it? People were blacklisted. Now, I actually question these figures because I can today use another method to actually register a family member in another name, blah, blah, blah. My wife still doing business. So I don't know if we really take, it's sort of as if, and I'm not saying members around this table, but it's as if people think it's the right thing to do. There's nothing wrong with it. And it's sort of get an approval stamp. It's fine. Just turn a blind eye. They make money. I'll get a kickback. We all know. It's as if we're not really, really, and we have unemployment, we have small businesses struggling to get off the ground and make a space in the economic world of this country. but we keep it all to ourselves. I just don't really understand how we cannot catch the people immediately. It cannot be that a member working on the personal system of government get either him or his wife or her and her husband or children. I can give you a list of provincial, but that's not the place to do it. How people in education get children studying at the university at 20, or not even 20 years old, getting 40 million, 7 million rand contracts to deliver school nutrition to schools in Limpopo. How on earth? It's not 10 cents. It's millions of rands. Denying those real small business people and entrepreneurs to give an opportunity to them, but we take it all for ourselves. How on earth and by when will we stop this? I don't think there's the political will and the seriousness to actually stop it now. Not next year. We'll sit here in 5 years in the new dispensation. We'll do it again. And we will still have people doing business with government. How on earth can you be dead and be a member of a company doing business with government? I really don't. And why, Chair, must Treasury catch us out in all 40 departments? Why can't every department not catch it out themselves? I'm really upset with this if you look at small people trying to make a living or other businesses, but they don't have the contact and they don't have the family working for government to get some deals. It's really not acceptable. Thank you, Chair.
Welcome, Zema. Over to you, Honourable MacArthur, I think.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, it's public knowledge that public servants at a lower level are underpaid. You find those public servants who would go out there and sell to us Tupperwares and perfumes just to get an extra income. But there are those who do not even make efforts to do those small things to, you know, get an extra income, like your senior managers, senior politicians within the department. They steal from the government coffers. They do business. They front with their kids. They do all sorts of tricks to get their hands on the public funds. The point I'm trying to make is that the departments that have not accounted on this matter, what are we saying about those departments? Because you will find out those departments that in fact did not respond to the issue at hand, you'll be surprised how many senior managers are fronting with their kids, with their families, how many politicians, senior politicians, are involved and have their hands on the public purse. So what are we saying, what are we doing with those departments that did not respond?
Thank you, Honorable Lutoma.
I think public works must attend to this gadget. You can't put your finger to press here, but it's for another day. Chair, there are three points that I would love to raise. One is a consistent matter, that how reliable is the parcel system? I know that it's one of our high-profile programs, but I'm raising that with the accuracy of the information that you have presented. Two, Chair, this one is an assumption statement that I'm making, which I would love to be corrected or affirmed. Are we only targeting senior management? If the response is going to be yes, Chair, the reason is that people who are perceived to be the masterminds are those ones who are at a very lower level, operational level. They don't even take leave to make sure that they close their gaps. So I've been an administrator, I know. Not because I've been part of the syndicate, but I'm just raising that. that when you dig deeper, why a person doesn't take leave, doesn't even mind not to pocket the leave days, what is the rationale behind that? So I'm raising that, informed by that perception. Let me use carefully this word without making unfounded allegations. Chair, probably, I'm not too sure, but the minister will look at this, not responding necessarily now, to say with the new entries, can't we also embed that in terms of commitment in their job letters, appointment and job description, as it were, as a more like a pre-commitment that thou shall not, because it's more than 10 years a habit that will take time. I don't know the legalities thereof, but if we then get so hard on this one, there must be then with the new entries not to beat the system, because they get smarter from both sides as well. This one, Chair, is the homework of, I think it's a Public Service Commission in collaboration with the Ministry. The SOEs as well, because also those ones also are more of government babies. We bail them out, but also we haven't paid much attention. I know that DPME will say that we'll answer that. What do we need to do as this portfolio committee to monitor that space as well? Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Gambela, do you have a question? Honourable Vama, I know you've just walked in. Do you have a question? Okay, thank you. No, thank you. Members, you know,
the most important thing, I think I'm going to take on what Honorable Mukausa was saying. One of the things we need to also consider, but I don't know if we are the relevant portfolio committee for this, is that, you know, as politicians, we are supposed to be exemplars. And it's not good to be hard on our staff when we are not hard on ourselves, you know, because you do find a lot of that, and it's even worse. I mean, you find people, the MECs, but in that same department, the person is the one who is involved as well, and I don't think that augurs well for ethical government. But having said that, the figures that you are showing us here, I'm not sure whether it's because we relied on PESAL, but I know that a lot of school principals that are also involved in school feeding schemes.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I want to link with that is that I do not get the rationale of going for to outsource this function, as opposed to employing people who are going from the community, who are also going to be growing vegetables in the school and cooking at the school. And we've had so many poisoning, I mean, especially in our province minister. We've had a lot of food poisoning. Why are we not establishing a kitchen? Because these kids are going to, it's going to be something that's going to be there for a very long time. Why do we have to be outsourcing this? And because once you start, and the thing, once you outsource this, the problem is that the standards, the nutrition and all that, it just gets compromised. Because people would buy anything, they would go as cheap as possible. They won't care about the nutrition of the child. They only care about how much they can make. So I think these things we will have to balance them. Maybe in terms of the implementation plan or of this legislation, we need to have different categories of businesses, because there are those that your Tupperware and what have you. Really, really, I don't know, unless somebody is going to be selling Tupperware, but somebody who is doing that is not doing business with the state. I mean, you are simply selling your Tupperware, and that's it. And in a country that is battling with entrepreneurship, honestly, really, let people sell their products, whatever products that they are selling. And what if we let's not criminalize things that are not
that are good, because that person is doing an honest living. You are just selling the Tupperware. Of course, it becomes a problem if the person is going to be using the time, you know, work time to sell that stuff. The other thing that I think I must say, which I also want to link you with this, is that you have a lot of people, and I don't see how this legislation is going to be effective unless we have a system in place of doing lifestyle audits. And the reason why I'm saying that is because people are going to take some, maybe somebody's going to take somebody who's a helper at home and make them the ones that get, you know, registered in the supplier database. And before you know it, I mean, we've seen clerks that are working at SASSA that are driving your Lamborghini. And you say, excuse me, how does this clerk, this kid, you know, these are the people that are, and they drive the Mercedes Benz and so forth. Unless we're going to have something that also goes with the lifestyle audits, especially amongst those high-risk individuals, because I think we need to categorize them. There are those that are, may not necessarily be your high-risk. Those are the people that may not have any influence on the supply chain processes and what have you. And you need to have the high-risk individuals within. And that is really talking about the implementation plan. Have we thought about that going forward so that this piece of legislation becomes effective? It doesn't become just something that is there, you know. And the other thing that I thought is also important is that I'm really, really going to be appealing to you, Minister. Can we really start thinking seriously about the incentives in the public service? We must be coming with these punitive measures, but we must also come with some of the incentives in the public service. You know, I think somebody was telling me that, you know, and during apartheid days, I mean, most of us, we know, people, if you were working in the government, you had all these other, you know, benefits for working in the government. And as a result, people were really respected their job. But I think now, the other day we were dealing with this housing subsidy thing, and we saw the kinds of conditions that we are putting with that. You can't access this housing subsidy if you are going to be building in a village. You must be building, you must have a bond from the bank. Why can't you just give the staff members that money? Because it's their benefit. These are the issues that I'm saying. Whilst we are doing this, you must not be doing it to a point where sometimes even your own children at home, when you are dealing with them, if you want to promote good behavior, you don't, or you are not going to be beating your child each time they do something wrong. Sometimes you have to do something, you have to praise them when they are doing something right. You know, you have to give them something when they are doing something right. You know, like at school, if you are getting something that's good, then you get a star, or you will get a smiley face or something like that. I am saying maybe this is what we ought to be thinking about as well, Minister. Because some of the things that we are coming up with are just not encouraging people to be in the public service. I wanted that old culture of people who were in the public service because they were there to serve. It's like now if you go, you come to the public service, you must be punished every day, you know. And it's worse when we as politicians are doing all sorts of nasty things out there. They can see us, we are doing all these things. When it comes to them, we become much stricter. So I am saying, I'm not condoning that thing, but I'm saying we need to be enforcing this and we are encouraging you, but you must also come up with a clear implementation plan that is identifying the high-risk individuals, and you also need to have lifestyle audits, because that's the only way we can deal with this. And there must be a consequence. I mean, when I was the job scoper in KwaZulu-Natal, one of the things, I'm telling you, this is a true story, an employee was actually had stolen money, you know, one of the these from a department there.
And this employee is punished, goes through the disciplinary hearing, and is fired. But then we had a policy that says an employee can appeal to the MEC. And the employees would appeal to the MEC and they will be reinstated. Now, we need to be looking at some of those things as well, especially when we are looking into provinces, because maybe at national level you don't have a lot of that, but at provincial level, I know that this happens a lot, because I remember I had endless cases of like that, where you find that an employee has been disciplined, gone through the disciplinary hearing, they then go back to the MEC and the MEC reinstates them. But I am also saying we need to find a way of coming up. Maybe let's relook at the whole incentive scheme in the public service, because I think we've taken too much away, including even the housing. We are now taxing. Remember that before, one of the things that was bringing a lot of people to the public service were these housing bonus, these housing subsidies. You remember? And we then started taxing those. We tax them as a fringe benefit. So before you know it, you have this thing, but it's meaningless. It's actually you are giving this thing, but you are taking it on the other hand. We need to be thinking carefully about the incentive scheme for our public servants. Because if you wanted to deal, if you really want a professional and ethical public service, we also have to look after our own staff. We must not get other people thinking that they can simply take the money of our employees and invest it in their businesses that are not bankable, you know. So we need to be careful about this. We must make sure that we protect our employees as well. We must make sure that they feel valued. They must not feel as if, you know, they are just there to be punished and to work and be punished only. But we must also think about those incentive schemes. And I would like the minister maybe to indicate what is happening in terms of that, because I want us to balance the two. I want us to be able to be doing this so that when somebody is doing this thing, there is no excuse whatsoever, you know, because we also have a very good regime of doing these things. Yeah. Over to you, sir.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Are you going to start, Minister, or you want to come last?
Let's start. It.
Okay. Yeah. You want to come first?
No, let him do it. I'll cover the payment issues that he
must do. Yeah, but also the thing is, you must observe protocols, Minister. He's going to find it difficult to speak after you.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to dispense with most of these questions, and the minister will deal with the most difficult political questions. Now, regarding the rationale for 6 month period, when we issued the directive and we said that all existing approval will have to terminate, we could not say they will terminate with immediate effect, because we had to make certain considerations. We had prior engagement with Department of Health, where the problem is very much prominent there. A lot of doctors, nurses who are performing remote work who had existing approvals. I can just give you an example. In Gauteng Department of Health alone, we have more than 1,000 of employees who are doing remote work. And now comes this directive, which is effective from 1 November, it has to make this consideration that, okay, if it's immediate, what is going to happen to the doctors, to the nurses and the social workers and a lot of health staff? Are we going to see people leaving the public service so that they can then focus on other remote work that they are engaged in? Or people are going to just resign and rather dedicate their skills and competence to the public sector. So,
does it include the moonlighting as well?
It includes moonlighting. Remote work, it includes moonlighting. Nurses, doctors, social workers, it includes teachers in the Department of Education. In fact, education and health is where the problem is so prominent. Now, 6 months was what was reasonable based on various engagements that we made with the different sectors, prior to the issuance of the directive. So in that 6 months, there will be certain things that we would do as a department, and there would be certain things that the departments would do with their employees. What we would do was to make sure that we raise more awareness about what is contained in the directive, what is contained in the transitional arrangements of the public service regulations, so that there isn't any excuse to say that we were not aware of these new provisions. In departments, the 6 months would allow people to make a choice whether they were going to be public servants or they're going to resign and focus on business. And we believe that 6 months is more reasonable. And going beyond 6 months, it was going to be very much unreasonable. So 6 months, yes, that's what we determined at that stage, that it would be reasonable. The 6 month period came to an end 30 April. Now, what we have seen happening, period 1 November to 30 April, things were happening at different times. There would be a department that immediately do a termination of the existing approvals, including those who were deemed. That's one thing that I need to also emphasize on. There were quite a number of people who were deemed approved. And deemed approval came from the Public Service Act Section 30, which says that if the executive authority does not do anything within a 30-day period, such an employee will then be deemed approved. So that had to come to an end. And only through a provision in this directive that says all of that, including those that were approved in reality, will come to an end. Now, we started to monitor the activities within PESA, and maybe yet then I'll immediately then reply to Honorable Lesoma about the reliability of this information on PESA system. The reliability is as much as it depends on the information that is captured. And in my presentation, I did explain that we undertook some training with all these ethics officers. And beyond the training on how to capture on PESA, we did a thorough briefing to all departments on the process that shall ensue if there is any new application. And in that process, you will be able to capture the application within the necessary 30-day period without going into a stage of deemed approval. So the information, we believe that is quite accurate, because the people who captured this information, they captured this information from the power of knowledge. They were trained by us and CETA, and they knew that they were, what they were doing. Now, what is interesting is, I'll go back to the numbers, 20 national departments, 17 provincial departments. And I can safely tell you with so much confidence that these numbers are not changing any significantly. The number of people who are applying, yes, it is changing, but the number of departments is not. February, March, April, it was still 20. March, it was still 20 national departments. By end of April, it was still 20 national departments. Still 20 national departments, but the number of applications are increasing. Now, what does that mean to us at the DPS? And now we have to look closely into this now. Okay, so it looks like only these departments are processing applications. So why? Why 20? Why is this number not increasing? And there are a number of reasons. 17 provincial departments from 6 provinces. The last change happened just recently with Northwest Department of Finance, and it's just one department that then changes 5 to 6 provinces, and it makes it 17 departments. There are departments that have undertaken that they shall not entertain any applications, so we won't see much changes. There is a province, Mpumalanga, I will specify that, that has issued a provincial directive that in this province there shall be no remunerative work performed by any employees. So if you look at the specifics, you won't see Mpumalanga on PESA system, surely because we know that the employees there are not allowed to undertake remunerative work. So a department can come up with its own policy, a departmental policy, to say that in this department we shall not undertake remunerative work, finish and slash. Some departments will say that we will entertain it based on what is contained in the application form. Now about the 7%, this slide basically says, now with all those who have captured this information, then we look at what kind of work is being approved by executive authorities. So consultancy, training, research and development, these are the people, somebody, and I will use NSG as an example now. This person previously was a lecturer at the university. And this person still wishes to become a lecturer at the university while still working for NSG. Then this person will seek permission to still supervise students at university. And then the executive authority will decide whether to grant permission. And if the executive authority grant permission, this person will be under the category training, research and development. So this person is not necessarily a consultant to the department, but this person was granted permission to still continue as a lecturer at the university, or to continue to mark examinations at the university. The same as I've already explained sales and marketing, I've already explained consultancy work. Some people are still doing consultancy work, and I'll give you an example. Those are specialized fields, risk management, people who then would sit in a risk management committee, maybe in local government or in another organization, and will categorize that as consultancy work. Employees that are flagged, ghost employees, how will they be detected? Honorable member, there's a lot of human behavior that cannot be policed by any system. Social and economic crimes, they happen, and sometimes they happen beyond anybody's radar. So we rely on what we have. We have the central supplier database. Now, in that system, whoever registers there as a supplier, they can either be an honest person or somebody's not honest. We have seen and we know that in certain departments, and we have heard yesterday from SCOPA, that in the South African Police Service, there's actually a cleaner who's registered on the supplier database who's actually doing business with the police, but he's a cleaner. And the question is, why would you then become a cleaner when you have this capacity to make money? Are you really a cleaner? I'll go back to my statement to say that we can only use the existing systems that we have, PASAL system, central supplier database, but we know that there's certain behavior that will always go undetected. And if it's detected, we will be happy because then there will be consequences for that individual. Whatever that we can put in place, we will still have dishonest people. Staff doing business with government, I think, yeah, those who are blacklisted have already covered that. Honourable member wanted to know if there is political will. Well, at the end, the buck stops with the executive authority, it stops with the head of the department. We provide this information. We wrote to the executive authorities, we wrote to HODs. We presented them with information and we said, look, this is what we see. Do something, take action where it's required. And provide us with the feedback in terms of what you have done. Some departments have come back to us and they have given us information and we have a breakdown of information where they have given us names of the individuals that have resigned from the public service. They've given us names of individuals who have resigned from the companies and those who were given letters, whether it's letters to warn them against their conduct. The problem is, what are we going to do with the rest who did not reply? And we know them, and we will continue to push. But here again, as the Department of Public Service Administration, this is where we're going to rely on the power of the oversight function, where we're going to utilize Section 16 of the Public Service Act, where the minister, upon sensitizing executive authorities, can be able to use 16B of the Public Service Act and present this information with the specifics that we wrote on the particular date to this executive authority. We did not receive reply, and present this information to cabinet. That is the only remedy that is left to us as a department.
Thank you, sir.
That's quite a number, but I'll leave the rest to the minister.
Okay, well, I will give the minister, but you know, I don't know if we will have another chance, because I suspect there's something fundamentally flawed with the way we are implementing this policy. To me, it seems to be shifting more to people who are doing the remunerative work than those that are doing work with the state, where we are really having a serious problem of corruption. I honestly don't think the intention of the policy was to stop a maths teacher who will go and teach at a school, and after hours, maybe this teacher is running some classes with, you know, students that are battling, can come there at a small fee. Really, to me, I honestly think I don't think that was the intention of this policy. But it looks to me as if we are focusing more on the remunerative work, which will mean that we will end up focusing on the non-staff, not the real staff where we have real leakages. You know, if our intention, our ultimate result is to bring down these irregular, fruitless expenditures of over 40 billion, we should be really be looking at the high-risk areas, where we're talking people who are involved in the procurement, that have an influence in the decision-making process and so forth and so forth. Why should we really be spending a lot of time with those people? Because they are hard workers. I mean, I don't know. I'm not comfortable with that. I'm also not comfortable with what you said. I mean, it's common knowledge about Mpumalanga. If you say Mpumalanga did not submit anything to PESA, are you suggesting that Mpumalanga is clean? Mpumalanga is not, that it doesn't have people who are doing business with the state? I don't know. What do you mean? What are you trying to tell us here? If you are saying they did not submit to PESA because there is some policy that says this and that, I have my doubts, because I've been to that province. And believe you me, this committee has been there, and we experienced horrors in that province. And I'm not so sure whether your information is as reliable as we would like it to be, but we will leave that to you maybe when you come back next time. Over to you, Minister.
Thank you, Chair. There are two directives here. The one that was signed by a minister and then became effective on the 1st of November is the one of employees who want to do some job outside the public sector. And there's another one that says directive on conducting business with an organ of state. At the end of it, there's an annexure A, which the minister has referred to say, when we say doing business, we are excluding the following. That includes participation in marking, training, teaching, or lecturing at a public institution.
Okay.
They are listed.
But he's giving us the impression that they are actually including that too. That is why I asked him about moonlighting, and he said, no, it's included.
Yeah. So that's the issue to say, then we're trying to say there are two directives. I think we should give you copies so that you go through them.
But then your staff as well must know, because they will be chasing people that they shouldn't be chasing.
Yeah, then let me just follow up then on the letter. I think what is left on us as Honorable Van der Waal side is our monitoring and capacity as a department. That's the issue that is the other issue that he has raised to say that for non-compliance of my cabinet colleagues will be able to also report. I'm meeting with the PSC on Monday to deal with this issue, to say also when it comes to provincial government and legislature, to say at the end of the day, whatever the PSC recommends, it ends either with the national parliament or the provincial legislature. The frustration is that there's no follow-up on the issues that they are recommending to say something that's not right. That's the issue that we need to seriously deal with. But nevertheless, I think on our side, as I spoke to the team when we were preparing for this meeting, to say then I raised the question to say, since January when we issued the directive, since February when we issued to HOD, what has been the progress? That is the question that I raised to say then, can you come with provincial specifics to say in the Limpopo Department of Health, I'm giving you a typical example. There is this chief director who's busy doing a business with the government. Had he stopped in terms of that because the directive required them to stop, failing which they should be consequence management. So I think I want to just to improve on our monitoring. These are our directives, then we need to own them to say, we have said that we have established a team of a DC panel of disciplinary people at national level. That's what we said to say that. These are matters wherein when provinces are failing to deal with, as DPSA, we need to start to say, this is an offense, somebody has to be disciplined. And like you said, the issue of the person, system as its own, I think people have raised issues, it's our own system that we're still working on. To say, out of our own, I think we can put in a database, because it's simple. The policies are very clear, what needs to be done, like to say, province specific, like I'll take you in Mpumalanga, the Department of Health, these are the number of employees that are doing business with it. But I also like that to say that there's a directive that was now issued as a department which was trying to also prohibit your immediate family members, spouses, that draft regulation in terms of the public administration exposure has been issued. I think we've seen the receipts coming from people. What we need to do is just to finalize it so that then even your cleaner, your work, your domestic worker now, if they are to do that. What I like about it also, cabinet has approved this issue of declaration to extend it also to all officials in finance, shouldn't be senior management only. Those ones that are driving Lamborghinis have approved that to say now they need to declare their financial interest. And then these are the issues that the PSC will start to monitor to see if you work in any portfolio that has got to do with procurement of government, you need to be subjected to that so that you will see. And I think issue of the last style audit that you have emphasized, I think we need to look at that. I know from the other side we are saying that, but I think as DPSA is the issue that also in terms of the policy directive, we need to start to look at it and focus on that. But I think what is very key as I hear members deliberating, it's our monitoring capacity as a department to monitor this, because what happens, the policy prescribes what needs to happen in the case, and then this issue of the directive on doing business with the state, I'm told in terms of the directive, it says that it's going to be effective from 1st of October 2018. So what is it? That's what it's in the policy. But then the directive, in terms of reporting, but the directive is signed 2017-01-27, and then it also says the directive shall take effect on the date approved by the minister. So those are the issues, but I think the reporting, in between now and October, what happens? Because the policy to me, it has been effective from the 27th of January this year. So these are some of the issues that we need to clean up today, but ours is just to make sure that we monitor, because that's our responsibility. We're responsible for these directives. So we need to monitor, and then where people are supposed to be taken to book, that has must roll to start that we are committed. Remember, this is our commitment that we're going to deal with corruption, in particular with the public service. And in so doing, then I think we have to monitor this. And I can assure you, these are the quarterly reports that we'll be able to update you on, in terms of consequence management as well, if need be. But I think ours doesn't end on that everything lies with the heads of the department or executive authorities. Something has to be done to make sure that there's compliance. I think that's what we need to calculate, like those reports that we send to cabinet to say all the time, Ministry X, it's a delinquent on this matter, a serial offender. These are the issues that we could always share with you to give you the progress.
Okay. Yes. No, thank you very much. Members, can we, I want us to proceed, but when it comes to this issue, I think we are in agreement that we will need to have a clear implementation plan of the both aspects of the policy, because you have the one of those doing business with the state and you have the remunerative work. And let's be clear, and the minister is telling us that she's going to go and do a bit of cleanup, and maybe you will have at some stage to come in and update us on how far you've gone with it, because we can't have one policy says with effect from this, but we then have a directive that is saying it will be effective in future. So what are we doing now?
Still
exactly. So, yeah, by that time we will have new challenges. Maybe we won't need to be focusing on this. So those are the issues that we think should be cleared. But thank you very much, Minister. Honorable Mokau has asked to be excused because she has an appointment with the doctor for up as well. Members, I'm very, very keen on the next report. Very, very keen, and I want you to, I don't want members to start asking to be excused before you hear that report from PSC. I think it's going to be very important that you get it. Honorable Soma, you wanted to say something, and Honorable Pandevati, you wanted to say something?
Chair, it's the one thing, one that the
just
the,
be so brief.
Can I, just one point, can I ask? Chair, while we are working on the 2018 and 2017 and in between and all that, but also it is important to declare and also resign for an company. But also the other one that you must, I'm suggesting that the minister looks at with the energy that she seems she has, is the what happens to the company. Because I can ask somebody to replace me as a director so I can continue influencing. So it's not influencing only without also stopping the ongoing concern that we tend to address. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Yes, Honourable
Chair, now that was part of what I was going to ask, but the other thing is maybe when the department comes back, the minister must also look on the issue of blacklisting. Because, mm-hmm. What exactly happens after a person or a company is blacklisted? Because in a year or two's time, I think I'm no more blacklist. I try again.
Yeah.
So there is a big thing about this blacklisting that people really taking a lot of chance on. So I think in the monitoring and the whatever, we should be updated on how is that being dealt with.
Yeah.
And how long is it valid for? Thank you.
Okay, we really agree. You wanted to say something, Minister?
Yes. Though I think we need to work with Treasury, because the issue of blacklisting in terms of the Treasury regulation,
yeah,
is Treasury's responsibility. I think then that's where we need to work together on this,
yeah,
matters, because at the end of the day, you do that, Treasury should blacklist. And I know of instances wherein you were told companies are blacklisted, but because it should be across, you find them doing work in the Free State, you blacklist them in Limpopo, then they're doing business in the Free State or in the National,
yeah,
Department. So these are some of the things that we need to look at.
The joint
system. Yeah. Anyway, over to you, Dr.
Commissioner
Ngozi.
Honorable Chairperson, honorable members, honorable minister, deputy minister, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. First, I would like to tender an apology for the chairperson having prior engagements. Then he sent me to represent him as a convener of Integrity and Anti-Corruption.
Okay.
The outline of the presentation will cover the introduction, which has to do with the legislative mandate and also compliance with the requirement to submit financial disclosure forms, scrutiny of the financial disclosure forms, action taken by executive authorities with regard to identified cases of conflict of interest, then it will be conclusion which covers the recommendations. The PSC has a constitutional mandate to promote the democratic values and principles enshrined in the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa 1996, including the values and principles set out in Section 195 of the Constitution throughout the public service.
that's the challenge that makes us not to go into SOEs and local government, because here it's just public service. One of those principles is that a high standard of professional ethics must be promoted and maintained. As part of promoting a high standard of professional ethics in the Public Service Commission manages the financial disclosure framework. Prior to 1st August 2016, the financial disclosure framework was contained in Chapter 3 of the Public Service Regulations 2001. The Public Service Regulations of 2001 were repealed by the Public Service Regulation of 2016 with effect from 1st August 2016. In terms of the repealed Public Service Regulations of 2001, all SMS members in the public service were required to disclose all their registrable interests annually to the executive authorities by not later than 30 April of each year. And the executive authorities were required to submit copies of these forms to the Public Service Commission by not later than 31st May of that particular year. And this provision has been retained in the Public Service Regulations of 2016. In this table, I am having compliance with the requirements to submit financial disclosure forms by 31st May. Here is a list of national departments that the submission rate was at 98%, and each province is. What I can say to the committee is that there has been improvement in the submission rate of financial disclosure forms by the 31st of May. Because now we have five provinces instead of having one province. In the past, it used to be Western Cape, but now we are having Free State, KZN, Limpopo, Northern Cape, and Western Cape, who have achieved 100% submission rate by the due date. Out of the 10,237 senior management service members in national and provincial departments, a total of 10,001, that is 98%, financial disclosure forms were submitted by the due date of 31st May 2016. The national department submitted 5,317, that is 91%, through e-disclosure, and 523, which is 9%, forms were submitted manually, of which it shows that there is an uptake and enthusiasm to use the e-disclosure, although by then it was not compulsory. The number of forms submitted by provincial departments was 4,107, that is 99%, which forms were submitted through e-disclosure, and 54%, that is 1%, of forms were submitted manually by the due date. Here is the stats of national departments that did not achieve 100% submission rate by the due date. That is, 13 national departments did not achieve the required 100% submission rate by the due date. Executive authorities have been advised individually to consider taking disciplinary actions against the transgressors who failed to comply with the framework. Here, when we receive the forms by the 31st of May, we first look at compliance before doing the scrutiny. That's where we write to individual executive authorities. The departments are listed there. What I can say to the commission, to the committee, is that some of the outstanding forms were from officials that were suspended, that were on suspension. Then we come to the issue of the state security. in the past, the committee said to the PSC, we have to consult with state security and find out why are they not submitting forms to the Public Service Commission. Then we met with the state security officials, of which they informed the PSC that they are regulated by the Intelligence Service Act 65 of 2002. They do implement the public service prescript for consistency, but only to the extent that the prescripts do not contradict the Intelligence Service Act. They also have said they have incorporated Chapter 2 of the Public Service Regulation of 2016 into their own policies. As a result, thereof, all state security agents members disclose their financial interests by the 30th of April each year to the Minister of State Security. Then they said they are having a unit within their department which verify and check the information before it is submitted to the Inspector General for possible conflict of interest. The identity of the state security members is a security issue, and therefore that's why they cannot release the names and everything to anybody outside the confines of the state security agent. In view of the above, it's not desirable for the financial disclosure forms of members of the state security to be submitted to the Public Service Commission along with those of the rest of the senior management service members in the public service. Scrutiny of the financial disclosure forms. In terms of the public service regulations, the Public Service Commission must assess compliance with the requirement to disclose all financial interests and also to establish whether the involvement of senior managers in any activities of companies that could lead to conflicts of interest. The scrutiny revealed that there are some members who did not disclose all their registrable interests, and those whose financial interests could be construed as posing potential conflicts of interest. This assertion is based on the likelihood that these SMS members could use state resources to further their private interests. The Public Service Commission therefore advised executive authorities to consult with the senior management service members concerned to discuss the steps to remove the conflict of interest. The executive authorities were further advised that in instances where the affected SMS members failed to take appropriate steps to remove the conflicts of interest after such consultation has taken place, disciplinary action should be taken against the officials concerned. In previous years, the Public Service Commission consulted with selected senior management service members within departments, and the public service was satisfied with the explanation given regarding their involvement in companies. What I can explain here, we consulted members whose companies reflected to be active in the CIPC. When we met those officials, most of them, they said their companies were dormant and they have never traded even outside or within government, so they just registered them. The Public Service Commission advised executive authorities to ensure that the involvement of these senior management services members in the companies is closely and tightly monitored. So that it does not lead to conflicts of interest. Executive authorities were also advised that should it transpire that such involvement poses potential conflict of interest, appropriate actions should be taken. Findings relating to non-disclosure of registrable interest. During the scrutiny process, the Public Service Commission established that some of the senior management service members did not comply with the requirements to disclose all their registrable interests, and failure to disclose all financial interests is regarded as misconduct. The Public Service Commission advised executive authorities to consider taking appropriate disciplinary action against the officials who did not comply with the framework in terms of the disciplinary code and procedure of the SMS handbook. A total of 827 SMS members failed to disclose their involvement in companies during the 2015-2016 financial year. 19 are on the level of DGs and HODs, and 52 are on DDG level. Full disclosure of property ownership was lacking in respect of 297 SMS members of both national and provincial departments. Here we are having a table of non-disclosure of registrable interest. There is the national department and the provinces, and we have also indicated the level of the officials who did not disclose. The first section is non-disclosure of companies, and the second one is non-disclosure of properties. Scrutiny of the financial disclosure forms reveals no cases of actual conflict of interest. May I explain this statement? The challenge here is that we are using two database systems, that is the CIPC and the DIS registry. In the past, Auditor General would furnish us with information when we request it. And the other challenge is that we would request departments to send us the supplier database that is in their department so that we could identify if an official has given his company, has registered his company's name in the database, in the supplier database of the department. But this time departments responded by saying now they don't have that because there is this central database in Treasury. And the other thing that we have a challenge on was that we did request to get into the, to access the bank, but Treasury did not give us that permission. As a commission now, we said during this financial year, what we are going to do so that we can be able to see whether officials are doing business with government, we will check all the active companies from CIPC of officials, list them, and submit that list to National Treasury so that they can check for us whether those companies were paid and have done business with the state. Then actual conflict of interest arises in instances of direct clashes between the private interest of an individual and their official responsibility as public servants. For example, where the SMS member's private capacity interest could influence them to improperly discharge their official duties and responsibilities. Cases of potential conflict of interest were identified in almost all the departments whose financial disclosure form were scrutinized. For example, where there is a likelihood that an official could use state resources to further their private interest. EAs were advised to consult with the officials concerned to discuss steps to remove the conflict of interest. Should officials fail to take appropriate steps to remove the conflicts of interest after such consultation has taken place, the executive authority must cause disciplinary actions to be taken against the officials concerned. When we write to executive authorities, we give them 30 days to revert to the PSC of actions that have been taken. Identification of cases of potential conflict of interest in respect of the 2015-2016 financial year overall findings. The stats is as they are then. What worries us is that most of the level of people who are having this potential conflict of interest are at the level of directors. That was our concern as PSC. Identification of cases of potential conflicts of interest in respect of the 2015-2016 financial year overall findings, that is the narrative. 17% of all SMS members in the public service were involved in activities that could be construed as posing potential conflicts of interest. We sometimes look at the activities of the company registered in the official's name, where sometimes you'll find out that a person is in HRM, human resource, and also is having a training company. That's where we also say there is a potential of conflict of interest. 17 SMS members on the level of DGs and HODs were found to be having potential conflicts of interest. The Limpopo province has the highest percentage of SMS members involved in activities that could be construed as potential conflicts of interest, that is 42%, while the Western Cape is the only province where...
I'm hoping that the minister, the deputy minister and honorable candidate is here. Because then you need a focus. Limpopo is not doing okay. That means you guys are not doing your job. Please, Commissioner.
That's okay. Other provinces with a high prevalence of potential conflicts of interest are Northwest at 34%, Northern Cape 33%, Gauteng 25%, and Eastern Cape at 21%. This year we have added this information to our report and also to the presentation. Officials who engage in remunerative work outside public service and amount of remuneration generated. We got these figures from what the officials disclosed in their forms. The performance of remunerative work outside the normal employment in the public service is regulated by the Public Service Act. It provides that public servants can perform or engage themselves to perform such work with a prior written permission of the EA of the department, but because now we have a new directive, this will change. The PSC found during the scrutiny process that there are SMS members who engage in RWAPs. Some of these SMS members provided evidence of approval by the executive authorities to engage in remunerative work outside public service, and others did not. Executive authorities were advised to consult with those SMS members who did not provide evidence of approval to determine if such approval was granted, and if not, to consider taking appropriate steps. Where the permission has been granted, executive authorities were advised to sensitize the SMS members not to perform RWAPs during official working hours and also not to use state equipment and or resources for such work. Officials who engage in RWAPs and amount of remuneration generated. EAs were further advised to sensitize also these SMS members of the provision of the Public Service Regulation of 2016, which among others forbids officials to conduct business with any organ of state. 215 SMS members in both national and provincial departments were engaged in remunerative work outside the public service during the 2015-2016 financial year. Out of this total, two are on the level of HODs in two provinces. The highest number of SMS members who were found to be engaging themselves in ROAPs were on the level of director, which amounts to 155. And the majority were found in national departments, which stands at 100. The reported total income generated from engaging in ROAPs during the 2015-2016 financial year was 16.4 million. This is a combined figure which was derived from calculating the amounts that were disclosed by the members. SMS members in provincial departments generated 6.9, and those in national departments generated 9.5. Then we also added gifts. In the past, we used not to include this one. The Code of Conduct for the Public Service prohibits public servants from receiving or accepting any gift from any person in the course and scope of their employment other than from a family member to the cumulative value of 350 per year unless approval has been obtained from the relevant executive authority. This provision should be read with Section 4 of the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act 2004, which provides for offences of corrupt activities relating to public officers. At the heart of the above is the need to ensure that gifts are not offered and accepted in the manner that contributes to the abuse of the position of authority which senior managers hold in the public service. In essence, the offering and acceptance of gifts should not serve as a springboard for improperly influencing officials in the performance of their public duties. Some SMS members have been receiving gifts, the value of which far exceeds the threshold set by the Code of Conduct. For instance, a total of 493 SMS members received gifts to the combined value of 6.3 million. SMS members in national departments received gifts to the total value of 4.9, and in provincial departments the total is 1.4. The situation in provincial departments is disconcerting considering thereof, particularly in KZN, where three SMS members on the levels of HOD received gifts to the combined value of 255,900. The highest concentration of SMS members who received gifts during the 2015-2016 financial year was also at the director level, that is 280. Then we come to action taken by executive authorities with regards to identify cases of conflicts of interest, just like as I indicated that when we write these letters to executive authorities, we request them to come back to the PSC with action taken within 30 days. So at the time of compiling this report, the Public Service Commission had received feedback from 6 executive authorities of national departments regarding action taken emanating from the findings made by when scrutinizing the financial disclosure forms. 2 executive authorities in national departments and 27 in provincial departments were satisfied with the explanation provided by SMS members regarding their involvement in private business entities. In view thereof, no actions were taken against the members. Then, 4 executive authorities of national departments and 10 in provincial departments sensitized the affected members of their duty to avoid conflicts of interest and to always disclose their registrable interest. 2 executive authorities in national departments and 8 in provincial departments took disciplinary action by issuing written warnings to the SMS members who did not fully disclose their registrable interest. 49 executive authorities of provincial departments did not provide any feedback to the PSC, and this is worrying. Then recommendation. What we recommend is that executive authorities should conduct assessments to determine the extent to which SMS members are engaging themselves in remunerative work outside the public service. In cases where ARWAPS is conducted without approval granted in terms of Section 30 of the Act, executive authorities must take appropriate remedial steps as stipulated in terms of Section 31 of the Act. Where permission to conduct ARWAPS have been granted in terms of the Act, the executive authority must sensitize the official not to perform such work during office working hours or use official equipment or state resources for such work. Executive authorities also should assess the extent of receipt of gifts and whether the acceptance of gifts has been in accordance with the Public Service Regulation of 2016. Where the regulatory provision has been contravened, the necessary disciplinary action must be taken. Executive authorities must ensure that all SMS members, including those that are on precautionary suspension or on leave, submit their financial disclosure forms. This will ensure improvement in the submission rate of financial disclosure forms by the stipulated due date. The PSC has noted that it is difficult for the department to obtain financial disclosure forms from officials who have been put on suspension. Often these officials are barred from entering the premises of the department for the duration of the suspension period. And for security reasons, the e-disclosure system is only accessible on government network. Despite the difficulties in obtaining forms from suspended officials, executive authorities are encouraged to do everything possible to get these officials to submit their financial disclosure forms. There has been a significant improvement in the submission of financial disclosure forms by the due date. There are still instances where designated officials submit their financial disclosure forms on time to their respective executive authorities, but executive authorities delay in submitting the forms to the PSC. The Public Service Commission cannot overemphasize the fact that if some departments can achieve a 100% compliance rate by the due date, then it is possible for all provincial and national departments to do the same. Then, despite the Public Service Commission interventions, there seems to have been little progress regarding the feedback provided to the Public Service Commission by the EA. the obligation to submit the financial disclosure forms to the Public Service Commission rests with executive authorities. The Public Service is therefore on the opinion that the National Assembly and Provincial Legislature should intervene and assist the Public Service Commission in ensuring that executive authorities comply with the requirements of the framework. Failure to fully implement the framework undermines the promotion of professional ethics. The framework should be regarded as part of a larger effort to regulate conflict of interest in the public service. While it is a crucial tool for preventing and controlling abuse of office by public servants, it cannot deal with the full range of conflict of interest situations that emerge at departmental level. However, the framework has assisted in raising awareness among public servants for the need to be transparent and accountable in the execution of their official duties. The management of conflict of interest forms an integral part in the public service initiative to become integrity and ethically driven. Through the identification and management of conflicts of interest, honest public servants are kept honest and integrity is promoted within the workplace. Compliance with the framework should therefore not be seen purely as a mandatory requirement, but as an ethical obligation of each and every public servant, especially at SMS level. Thank you, Chairperson Nyabong.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Members, there is the report of the PFC. Honorable Lusoma, is there any question? Honorable Van der Vaart?
Only one.
Honorable Verma? If you don't have a question, Honorable Dombela, or you only have one, or I thought you were saying I must take only one question. Okay, no, then you will come after Fema. Yes, Lusoma?
Chair, probably let's start by appreciating the update in terms of the progress. But also for me, I think we shouldn't separate the earlier discussion from this one as well. That will bring me to the issue, Honorable Minister, to assist us in terms of the how to go about to implement the lifestyle audit. Because lifestyle audit can talk more than what we are getting. But we are not doubting the issue. At least there is an increased appetite of compliance from the province, which you really welcome that one. What else I wanted to say? No, let me leave it there, that they must be talking to each other as well in terms of other issues that DPSA should be attending to moving forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Honourable Sonnet.
Chair, I also believe that there's a similarity in concerns towards the previous presentation. But there are some things I just wanted to point out. You know, Chair, if you look at, slide 7, I suppose, on IPET, for example, then the 37 SMS members, and 11 of them didn't submit. I mean, you know, in that type of a environment, it just clashes with principles completely. How is it possible? The other issue, I mean, there are lots of questions, Jen. I know everybody's looking at their watches. I found an interesting one on slide 13 or page 13 was the issue of non-disclosure of properties. I drove in a town the other day where I found that an ordinary traffic officer has got most probably the biggest house I've ever seen in the Waterberg. I really... It's easy to get a lifestyle audit, by the way. But I think we must be serious about it. That's the issue. And that doesn't exclude municipal managers, for example. Everybody... Now, I know municipal managers aren't part of a of the of DPSA, but you know, those are the examples. You can go and learn a lot. And then, Chair, I'm just keen also to, on my page 16, where you say 70% of all SMS members in the public service were involved in activities. Now, if you go further, we see the horrific stats of Limpopo province, which is actually almost half. If you take 42%, it can just as well be 50%, noting the Western Cape at zero. But despite who governs those provinces, there must be best practices that we can copy. You know, if another department at national level does well, we must go and copy, see what do they do right. And the same goes for provinces. It's all South Africa. And then, Chairperson, I also made a note of, on some of the stats where you spoke on my page 20 of the gifts, the values of gifts. So in the first bullet point you said a total of 493 SMSs, received a combined value of 6.3 million. But the next two bullet points, you only give the value in rand. Is it one member or more? Because if it's one member getting a gift of 1.4, I would really want to know who that is or what duty that person is in the provinces. So there must be some sort of an indication what number of SMSs are we referring to. Says that SMS members in national departments receive gifts to total value of 4.9 million, but not the number of the members. And the provincial ones, 1.4, but it doesn't say is it 10 or 1 or 100. I think that also, you know, can be screwed. Chair, I'll leave it, and I assume that EA stands for Executive Authority. Okay, so I wasn't too blunt. And then, Chair, I see that there are still instances where designated officials submit the disclosure forms on time, but they are delaying ones in submitting forms. Surely there must be some consequence if you don't submit on time. I mean, members of parliament, if you don't submit your declaration by a certain time, you go to the ethics committee. So what happens to these officials, especially in the sense that they are the seniors in the departments? Nothing, I suppose. So there's no consequences. I'd love to have a boss where there's no consequences if I don't operate according to the rules.
Let's go and join the public forum.
Yeah, I think I should apply. Will you take me? Chair, no, I mean, it's dead serious. This is a precondition. When you sign your contract for job, that's in your job description, this is what we expect of you, and this is what you do. Across the world, I can go to the corporate world. I have a contract with that company. You were there, I was there, others were there. You can't just do as you please.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Chair, those are a few of my observations just on this presentation. Thank you.
Okay, no, thank you. Honourable Verma?
Thank you, Chair. Apologies for arriving late. I have my university in Washington, D.C.'s president arriving in Cape Town today, and I'm hosting her, so I had to meet her. So sorry I'm late. My apologies. She's the first deaf president for that specific university, so that's why I'm very proud to have her here in Cape Town. Just two questions that I have. The gift. Does it have categories? So, for example, my constituency or for the deaf community, I invite the public service to come and do a presentation, and we buy a very small gift. Do they not accept that? If I have different speakers and not all of them are from the public service, sometimes the administrators don't feel that it's fair that we give gifts to other people, but public servants say, no, we can't receive the gifts. So do we have different categories of gift, or is it just no gifts at all? And then the second question, the executive authority doing disciplinary processes, yes. But if the EA delays, does the PSC chase after them to make sure they do the disciplinary requirements, or does the EA make the decisions, you know, whether they do it or not, or does the PAC follow up on that? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable Ntombela, with your one question.
Yes, Chairperson, thank you. This kind of report has been going on for quite some time, and the format of the presentation has always been the same. Can't we change the format? I'm of the opinion, Ute, don't you think it's about time that we name and shame? We get the DG's name, the DG's Mr. Biela. Mr. Biela from this department, and the EA is Mr. Ntombela, and then we publish it. And then see what happens. I mean, our focus should be not on those that comply, but those that do not comply. So it's not everybody who's going to go to the publications, but only the culprit. So I'm of that opinion. I don't know how other people feel about it. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, I think that is supported. What do you want, Honourable Sir? You want to say something?
I thought that in general, each and every financial year end, the PSC does produce a booklet with all the names, so inverted commas, name and shame, because it's pose issues as well, but they can confirm that one. That's all I wanted to say.
You know, I was hoping that members were going to ask this question. I'm trying to understand what kind of gift will cost 250,000. Is it the whole furniture of a house? What? Oh, art. What kind of
What is
it?
It's official.
This is for two HODs, not one. We'll see when we combine the total. The issue, I cannot cite this one of 256, but I can cite one of which I'm aware of when the official received a watch from Saudi Arabia costing
130,000.
Okay. But what made it also to come to this number is most of them are at 10,000. It's the Vodacom July or the Cape Town Jazz, where you get to the package. Some, especially those who are in jail, because they went outside the country, they get those where the price then becomes high when you compare it to the rest.
But Chair, I'm going to two finger on that if
yeah?
I may. The irony of that is that the jazz festival, for example, is actually sponsored by government.
Various departments, not only
government
departments, and also the service providers, like the MCN and Vodacom.
I think Honourable Ntombela is really summarizing this thing for us, because we really do have a challenge. But you know what? To me, there is something that I mean, just reading this report, something tells me that our public servants are beginning to beat the system. Because, I mean, I can't understand that, like in my province and the Free State, when you speak about the the conflict of interest, you're only talking about 1%, it doesn't make sense. I'm saying there must be something that is happening there. Unfortunately, with these things, we keep on chasing the goalposts. Once they know that you've come up with this legislation, they will find something else. And unfortunately, that's how things are. But the reason why it's going to be extremely difficult, it will be very interesting to know, you know, especially with the staff at SCM staff, it worries me a great deal there, because if you have those supply management staff that are not doing business, that are disclosing that they've received this or that, obviously with them it should be concerning us, because it's directly related to the work that they do. And also because they know the threshold, that it's 350 rands per annum. Why do they accept those kinds of gifts? You know what I mean? It doesn't make sense to me. You are in the SCM, and the reason why you are there is because you are responsible for this job of overlooking, of adjudicating over this process, tender processes. And now you are getting gifts that are way above the threshold. And I wanted you maybe to share with us that the six million that you said is the total value, is out of how many individuals?
Okay, can I specify responding now to all?
Yeah.
How to implement lifestyle audits?
As a commission, we do have a concept document. We wanted to conduct lifestyle audits because of, through the financial disclosure forms, our findings, where you find that there is an official who's at a DDG level, but staying in a 9 million house, and when you look at the companies that have been disclosed or the additional one, when you go to CIPC, you'll find that the official is having 21 companies. So then we introduce the issue of lifestyle audit to the commission, where we did prepare concept documents. We even invited the chief state law advisor to come and address us whether we can conduct it. But now the issue was with the issue of rights.
Yeah.
Mm. That's why we do have a concept document, Chair, of which we can forward it to you. But we ended up not implementing it because of the issue of rights.
No, I was not saying we must implement it through chair. I'm saying that we must talk to the minister and see the other possibilities, because I'm aware of that legal issue with the director.
I was just informing that we once tried, but we ended up not implementing it. So that we do have the concept document, of which we can forward to the minister and to yourself, just
yeah,
to have a look.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm.
Instead of starting a new thing, so that when we
can work.
Yeah,
because I want to understand how your rights come in there.
With that one, we will forward it to the minister and to the chairperson.
This is not privacy. Mm. This is not intrusion into your privacy. It's really about... Yeah. I mean, then we won't be able to also, then banks won't be able to implement FICA.
Mm.
Because you must remember that banks, it's very strict there, you have confidentiality clauses. I think this thing we need to talk about and get the legal opinion, maybe get a state law advice to come and talk to us about those issues. Because I honestly don't think that the mere fact that you are in the public service, public, is already saying something.
You are a public entity. I agree, Chair. I submitted a question the other day on some info, and our office stopped it, blocked it, and they said, I can't ask this because of the radar. It's exactly the same.
No, I think we need to engage on those issues. Otherwise, people will continue doing what they do. Yes, continue, Commissioner.
Honourable Van der Vaart, the number of where we gave the stats for national and not provincial, about the gifts, it's provincial, it's 155.
Where is it on page 18?
Where we only talked about province, not giving the stats. Where we say SMS members in national departments receive gifts to the total value of 4.9 and SMS members in provincial departments received gifts to the total value of 1.4. Most of the information that is not here is in the report, which I think is tabled today. Then,
Commissioner, just answer the question within the next 5 minutes.
Yes, and most of them were not questions, were comments. The issue of gifts, the challenge with gifts is that they say in some cultures when you offer a person a gift, denying that gift is not on. It seems like you are not respecting the person. So that
as long as this is a cow or a chicken or a goat.
So, honourable members, the categories of gifts, we don't have a category of gifts of which to be received or not to be received. But when you are a speaker, when you are given a gift, most of the time it's not an expensive gift that you can declare to your department. The DG will come on that one. We also note the issue of naming and shaming. Honourable member, we are going to pass that to the commission so that we can take a decision, so that the report is one and almost the same. It's time that we move on to also focus on those who do not comply in naming them. Sometimes that will make it to be 100% compliance. DG, issue of gifts.
I think that what is more important, Honourable Chair, through you, with regard to gifts, is to say, in terms of the code of conduct, whatever gifts one receives, one must declare. So I think the issue is not the prohibition, the issue is the declaration. And I think that's what we're seeing here, that many officials are receiving and declaring. It was going to be incorrect if they had received and not declared.
But there is a question there that you are overlooking, DG, is that, you know, there is a threshold here of how much you could get as a gift. And also, there is something that doesn't seem to be a gift. You know, once something is going into 100,000, to me, is that still a gift? I don't know. Maybe I'm a small money kind of person. I don't know. Maybe to you it's okay. Somebody can give you $1 million and then it's a gift. It's okay. Oh, I'm just saying, there are gifts that are acceptable. Once a gift goes to those extremes, maybe somebody is trying to court you, but not anyway. Okay, anyway,
so yes. Now, I think the threshold, you're right, Honorable Chair, in the sense that the threshold is 350 in terms of saying, if it is more, the value of the gift is more than this much, which is the 350, you must declare. But in many instances, because you are not part of the buying, you might not even know the value of it. Hence, now the issue is declare across the board. But indeed, there are certain type of gifts that indeed are worrisome, particularly if they are in line of your work and are coming from a service provider. Surely there is a saying that says there's no free lunch. It is possible that one might be saying, in future, consider me, don't forget me, if so-and-so comes your way. So we do note that. But I think what is more important, as we're saying, according to the code of conduct, it says declare and declare. And I think we note that declaration.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
No, let's leave it at that. I don't think we'd win. Yes, Fanessa?
Okay, surely if an official gets a 100,000 rand gift, even if he or she declares, I really think that's huge. And then you must go and see whether that donor of the gift was involved in some business. Like a supply chain manager, I cannot believe that anybody in that position or awarding of tenders, bid committees, what, can get any gifts, for example. But you know, if I visit the ambassador of King William, whatever country, and he comes back with a Persian rug, compare to getting $100,000 of, I don't know, but I'm the supply chain manager on the HOD and we just awarded a contract to your company. So there must be checks and balances, not only declare. Because what are you going to do if I declare 5 million rand? Because I just got a Rolls Royce. You're going to say, that's fine, she declared. Why did I get that gift? That's the question.
I think you are capturing the essence, but I think that's a debate for another day.
Yes,
Honourable Dombele.
I know of a DG who's got who's running business with government. He has approved an entity, actually, as a conduit to the public. Funds and so on, and but he's got a company that that is involved in that, and I want to report it. How do I go about it? I want to be a whistleblower. How do I go about
because
it?
Because you are actually obliged by the legislation to report.
Yes.
Because if you keep quiet,
but of course, it's not from the Free State. Don't ask too many questions.
Okay.
So I just want to know how it
works. There is a good citizen here who wants to whistleblow.
Yes.
Oh, 0800 701 701. If you come to the commission, and you can either report anonymously or you can.
But we know now it is.
Yeah,
like reporting to the war. They get after 3 years, the latest they were there.
Anyway, thank you. Okay. Members, listen, we thank you very much. We will deal with the minute members next week because I have to go somewhere. Yes, Honorable Vema.
Sorry, my other question, if an EA doesn't follow up on the disciplinary processes, what support does the PSC provide to the EA to make sure that the EA does the disciplining and the disciplinary actions are followed up and done? It wasn't responded to.
Can we have a written response from you, Commissioner?
Okay, thank you.
Please, on that question.
We
are meeting next week. Yes, Honorable Ntambi.
Thank you.
We're only going to the oversight visit a week after. Yes,
Chair,
the
issues that I wanted to again emphasize, remember the PSC reports to Parliament rule yourself as a committee.
Yes.
And then I think you need to help them. Their frustrations that they get through the executive authorities not complying. She was whispering to me as well that there's a lot of grey areas that also as a ministry will have to also support. But I think yourselves as a portfolio committee, that political oversight, because they'll produce reports. We'll also send similar reports to cabinet.
Yeah.
But when you see the majority of the executive authorities are not responding. I think that oversight will need to.
No, we are definitely going to do that, and I think
because they were sharing with me the other interesting story to say they were trying to probe another executive authority who didn't comply. Then I think he or she intimidated them, said that they had to stop that investigation. But I think that's the issue that you need to seriously help them.
No, we need to deal with that, and we are definitely going to help them. And we in fact, at our last few meetings, we've been saying the commission is at the center of what we do, because most of the work, they inform even our own oversight diseases. The work that whatever their findings are, that's what we use to select, you know, the places that we could be going to for oversight. But thank you very much.
We actually have a piece of legislation that was supposed to have been before this committee.
Yeah,
some
weeks ago. No, that piece, don't open new
wounds.
It's coming. That's coming. Yeah. The minister is going to have to open that door.
I'm going to Bain Mainstream for everything.
Please. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
I'm going to tell you the two words I'm going to say. Thank you.
You can have it.
And then she comes towards the end of the meeting.
I'm
going to